Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
So far, nothing much in it. But from now on, it becomes one of the most extraordinary and puzzling fights of all time. Clay didn't want to come out for this round. He's complaining there's something in his eyes that he can't see properly. He believes it's something that's come off Liston's gloves. He's only in there now because Angelo Dundee, his trainer, shoved him out for a fifth and told him to get on with it. I'll swear that not one of us in that Miami Beach arena could have predicted what would happen next. 100 different theories have been advanced as to why this fight ended so strangely. Most of them are libelous. The most charitable theory is that Liston was telling the truth and that his shoulder was bad. A more cynical explanation is that he knew by this time he was in for a beating and he couldn't face it.
Sonny, 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 what happened? Get up, the bell rung. Sonny, get up. Don't quit. Sonny said, my mother did not raise no fool. I'm going to stay right here on my stool.
And what's happened? Clay has won! Clay has won! It's all over at the end of the sixth round, and Cassius Clay is the new champion of the world!
Sonny, how much did it hurt you when you lost that title?
Damn it. More than words can explain.
It's just over a week since Cassius Clay won the heavyweight title. People all over the world are still talking about this amazing character.
I feel real good. I've always said that I was the uncrowned champion. And I always had the feeling that I was the champion. As a matter of fact, I knew I was the champion before the fight.
There are still a lot of people, both here and in America, who simply can't believe that the fight was fair and above board. What do you say about that, Cass?
Well, a lot of people say that the fight was fixed. It was funny, only because of the shock of losing all of their money. You have a fellow over there who knocked me down, and I don't like it, and I haven't forgot it, and it really embarrassed me. And I want to show the world that he's nothing either. And I want to give him a shot at my crown, that Henry Cooper. I want him right there in London, England.
Well, Henry Cooper is keener than ever to have a shot with you.
I'm looking for him, too.
Britain met him for the first time in 1963. He wasn't champion yet, but he was already world famous. The man who predicted the round and always seemed to be right. He was here to fight Henry Cooper.
He caught me in the corner and he hit me with a left hook. And it was a hard one.
The bell has sounded and he's up at about three, Clay. That was the end of the fourth round and he hit him about 2 seconds before the end of the round with a left hook. Clay took one chance too many, and he still doesn't know where he is. They're working furiously on him in the corner. Angelo Dundee, his trainer. He really is giving him a talking to. Now this crowd at Wembley are beginning to bay for a Cooper win. Clay on the floor at the end of the fourth, and now fighting to preserve his professional life here against Henry Cooper. Oh, and now Cooper's left eye is really in a shocking state. It really is now. And I think Tommy Little will have to stop this because Cooper's eye is really in an absolutely appalling state. And now he's slipping in, and I think this is it.
Cooper, of course, couldn't go on. To this day, we still like to play the game of pretending what might have happened if Cooper had hit him a little earlier in the fourth. What might have been didn't matter. Clay had said five rounds, and five rounds it was, whether we liked it or not. Henry had given Clay his final test. I don't think any of us, maybe not even Clay, imagined that he'd be world champion in another 8 months.
K, Cass, who's that you've got there with you in the New York studio?
Come here, Sam. I got the British press here. This is Sam Cooke. As you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Well, let's give him a sample.
Come on, let's give him a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We'll try it now.
Hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Do it again now.
Hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one. Yeah.
How you like that?
And I'll see you guys later.
All right, Sam. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cass.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 26th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our seventh study session on Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, the co-authors, suspected racists, Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. We're picking up on chapter 13. Last week's session detailed Muhammad Ali, well, at the time, Cassius Clay, becoming the heavyweight champion of the world, defeating Sonny Liston. We are rapidly approaching the demise of Ali and Minister Malcolm's friendship. That will be detailed more this week. The segment that you heard, Muhammad Ali, he did a lot of interviews worldwide, a lot of interviews, but this week you'll hear them mention some of the interviews that he did with the BBC's Harry Carpenter. Those are some of the segments that Ali did with Harry Carpenter. They have extensive interviews that Ali and Carpenter conducted over the years on YouTube. If you want to check them out in further detail, there's actually an entire documentary detailing their years of dialogue and exchange. So check that out in your free time if you are so inclined. We will go ahead and get started. We are on Chapter 13, The Shakeup. This is the context of white supremacy, Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, audio segment number one.
Chapter 13, The Shakeup. Boxing is sport, not politics. But Cassius Clay, without any political experience, would immerse sport in politics. A.S. Doc Young, Los Angeles Sentinel. Cassius Clay arrived in New York on a mission. "I'm going to shake up this town," he announced. On March 1st, around 3 p.m., after riding more than 1,200 miles in his bus, Big Red, he and his six-man entourage checked into the Hotel Teresa. Clay stepped off the bus, in no mood to celebrate. Crossing the Mason-Dixon line convinced him once again that he would rather live in New York than Louisville or Miami. "I'm heavyweight champion of the world, yet for a day and a half I had to eat bologna out of a bag, simply because I'm black," he complained. At every southern stop, white men could not have cared less that he was the heavyweight champion. No black man, they reminded him, was welcome in a white restaurant. And yet he could not understand why his own people, he said, so-called Negroes, still asked him, "Why are you a Muslim?" Clay felt more at home on the streets of Harlem, where black fans gave him a hero's welcome. "I could be living all exclusive downtown in some skyscraper," he said, but he preferred being around his own people at the Teresa. His face broke into a wide smile when a crowd of black kids rushed toward him, shouting his name. For more than an hour, he signed autographs in the lobby. At a hotel with mostly black clientele, he figured that he would not find any trouble, except for the women who showed up at his suite at all hours of the night, posing as Muslims. At the corner of 7th Avenue and 125th Street, the Hotel Teresa sat at the nexus of black culture. A white terracotta building situated near Harlem's most popular nightclubs and the Apollo Theater, the Teresa was known for catering to black celebrities. Writers, actors, bandleaders, and athletes found everything that they needed inside the hotel. Multi-room suites, business offices, a barbershop, beauty parlor, bar, and restaurant. Reporters looking for a scoop came to the Teresa, knowing that something newsworthy was always happening. All they had to do was tip a doorman, and they were bound to learn something that they could write about. Every night, it seemed, somebody important, a diplomat or a national leader, stayed at the Teresa. Castro, Lumumba, Nasser, Nkrumah, and Khrushchev, a who's who of American critics, had all visited the Waldorf of Harlem. Outside the 13-story hotel, soapbox speakers railed against the white man while paperboys sold copies of the Amsterdam News. Across the street, radicals held court at Louis Michaud's African National Memorial Bookstore. Surrounded by stacks of books, pamphlets, and magazines, Michaud, a slight septuagenarian known among nationalists as the Professor, educated visitors about history and politics, telling old stories about his days in the United Negro Improvement Association. Malcolm became one of his most prized pupils, listening intently as the former window washer preached about Pan-Africanism and American hypocrisy. One time, as he often did, Malcolm pulled out a pocket-sized notebook and a red pen, jotting down something Michaud had said about America's chickens coming home to roost. After his banishment from Mosque No. 7, Malcolm moved into an office at the Teresa. Even though the most famous Negro hotel in the country was no longer the popular destination it once was. In fact, it was never really the glamorous getaway writers made it out to be. With its dimly lit hallways, drab, colorless bedrooms, dingy, ancient furnishing, and limited room service, the Teresa, Ebony Magazine noted in 1946, is anything but a first-rate hotel. In the succeeding years, the hotel's owners neglected necessary repairs, and the building began deteriorating, along with the neighborhood around it. By the time Malcolm settled into Suite 128, the hotel's white brick was smeared with soot, its luster long gone. Malcolm's mezzanine office had served at one time or another as a brokerage firm and a cosmetics company, and traces of both were still present. When visitors reached his office door, they could still read an old hand-painted sign, Eve Nelson Cosmetics. Inside the large conference room, sparsely furnished with two cluttered desks and a few folding chairs, Malcolm designed his future plans, pinning news clippings to a bulletin board and writing ideas on a wall-sized chalkboard. It was an unimpressive workspace, but Malcolm recognized that its proximity to his former mosque, the home that he had known for the past decade, made it an ideal place to set up his new headquarters. When Cassius checked into the hotel, he visited with Malcolm for a secret conference, only they did not meet in his mentor's office. Instead, Malcolm came to him, knocking on Clay's suite door. Even before Cassius became champion, from the moment Malcolm set foot in Miami, their relationship fundamentally changed. Cassius, the title contender, altered Malcolm's thinking. In a moment of weakness, he exploited his friendship with Clay, manipulating him and withholding the truth about his future in the nation. In a desperate attempt to prove his value to Elijah, he offered to deliver Clay to Chicago after the title fight, treating Cassius like some prize that could be bartered or traded. But Elijah did not have to buy Clay's loyalty. He already owned it. Reporters assumed that Clay was Malcolm's most devoted follower. One New York writer claimed that an insider told him that Clay was solidly in Malcolm's corner and would prove influential in helping his friend to establish a cult of his own. Other writers speculated that if Cassius teamed with Malcolm, then Elijah would lose many of his followers to their rival Muslim movement. By all appearances, Cassius and Malcolm had never been tighter. After Cassius arrived, later that afternoon, they toured Times Square, parading the streets and shaking hands with strangers as if they were running for office on the same ticket. When a reporter from the Amsterdam News spoke to Malcolm, he gave no indication of trying to persuade Clay to leave the nation. He was still waiting for just the right moment to tell him the truth about Elijah. Cassius, he told the writer, dances like Sugar Ray, punches like Joe Louis, and thinks like Elijah Muhammad. In time, Malcolm would wish that Cassius thought more like him. Later that evening, after watching a film of Clay's championship match at a theater, Cassius and Malcolm were surrounded by a crowd of nearly 500 on Broadway at Times Square. While Clay signed more autographs, photographers snapped pictures of Malcolm standing beside him with a satisfied smile on his face. Seeing them together, reporters concluded, no one could doubt that they were planning a bold political initiative. Clay felt he had jumped beyond the world of sports. "I'm shaking up Times Square now," he declared. "In a few days, I'll shake up the United Nations. I'm going to meet all the delegates." After speaking with writers and fans for about 25 minutes, Clay and Malcolm squeezed through the crowd, making their way toward a limousine, and disappeared. The next day, March 2nd, Malcolm arranged for them to visit the offices of the Amsterdam News, where Clay said he would no longer acknowledge the name of a Kentucky slave master. "Now," he said, "I will be known as Cassius X." When a reporter at the News asked him about Elijah and Malcolm, he feigned ignorance of any rift between them. "Elijah Muhammad is the sweetest man in the world," he said. "Malcolm X? I fell in love with him after watching him on television with those educators, leaving them with their mouths wide open." Malcolm was not the only friend Cassius visited in New York. The following evening, he met Sam Cooke at a Columbia recording studio on 7th Avenue, where they cut a snappy rendition of "Hey, Hey, the Gang's All Here." Since the previous summer, when he'd covered Ben King's hit song "Stand By Me," Cassius had become more comfortable in the studio, though he still sounded a bit tentative when he sang. On his album, The Greatest, he did not really sing, he mostly recited poems, but his unbridled confidence and Sam's encouragement convinced him that he could become a singer. Realizing Cassius's range was limited, Sam arranged for him to perform a simple, fun tune that accentuated his soulfulness. Later, Sam and Cassius appeared on BBC's Grandstand. Host Harry Carpenter had met Clay in England before the Cooper fight, and now detected that Cassius was a changed man. The champ admitted that he had changed, and that he no longer needed to talk like I used to. Yet he struggled with his identity. He was unsure how he would express his new freedom now that he was champion, and the world knew that he was a Muslim. Only a few months earlier, he told the Louisville sponsoring group that he no longer wanted to be a showman. He was not interested in being a clown on television. He'd said that he wanted people to take him more seriously. But now, his representatives at the William Morris Agency were in the middle of negotiating a deal involving millions of dollars, where he would perform on television, on tour, and on more records. It was an enticing offer that made him reconsider his position. Ultimately, the negotiations broke down when booking agents and record executives learned more about his relationship with the black Muslims. "Malcolm X," one New York columnist learned, "has cost him a fortune in endorsements, TV shots, and disc sales." If he was not careful, Elijah warned, Malcolm might cost him much more. Captain Joseph called Elijah on March 4th and told him that Malcolm had informed a local radio station that his suspension was over and that he had been reinstated with his full responsibilities. Stunned, Elijah replied, "Well, I'll stop him." Muhammad then mailed Malcolm a letter informing him that his suspension remained indefinite. Furthermore, Elijah told Captain Joseph, Cassius should not visit the UN with Malcolm during his suspension. In the meantime, Muhammad continued to calculate his next move. The next afternoon, March 5th, around 1 p.m., Cassius, Rudy, Archie, and Malcolm arrived at the United Nations, where they met with delegates from Africa and Asia. As the group entered the delegates' lounge, African dignitaries greeted Cassius and Malcolm with invitations to visit their countries. "We're proud of you. Come whenever you can," a Liberian ambassador said. "Thank you, sir," Cassius replied. "I have longed to go back home to Liberia." Cassius floated in a room of important men, all paying homage to him. Esteemed political figures from around the world knew his name. They knew that he was champion, the first Muslim champion of the world, and they treated him with respect. He recognized that he was becoming a global figure, champion of the whole world, he emphasized. The people are really shook up, and they look at me as if I was a messenger or prophet or something. During their conversations with African leaders, Clay deferred to Malcolm. He was uncomfortable speaking and uneducated about the issues concerning African nations. Watching Malcolm interact with ambassadors, Cassius recognized that Malcolm's relationships with African leaders could help elevate his own standing in the world. It was obvious, journalist Murray Robinson concluded, that Malcolm had set out to make the heavyweight champion an international political figure. Reporters wondered if Malcolm had scripted the entire week in an effort to strengthen his bond with the champ. Malcolm's critics suggested that he was just using Clay. The champ, a writer from Sport maintained, had become nothing more than a tool in Malcolm X's feud with the Muslims. After Malcolm and Cassius made plans to travel the world together, Ryder speculated that Clay's visa might be withheld, given his uncertain military status. When the Louisville Courier-Journal published a story that Cassius had failed a military intelligence test, reporters pressed him about his case. He did not know if he passed the selective service exam he took on January 24th in Miami, but he insisted that it was difficult. "I finished Louisville Central High School," he said, "but I wasn't very bright. I was in the Golden Gloves and didn't have time for studies." If he passed the test and was drafted, writers asked, would he oppose military service on religious grounds? Did the NOI oppose military enlistment? Would he declare himself a conscientious objector? Cassius was unaware of the nation's opposition to the army and Elijah Muhammad's past imprisonment for draft evasion. In fact, he had no idea what it meant to be a conscientious objector. "I just want to do what's right," he said. "I don't want to go to jail, and I don't want to get into trouble." On the morning of March 6th, around 7 a.m., Malcolm picked up Rudy and Cassius at the Teresa in his dark blue Oldsmobile 98. During their drive back to the U.N., Malcolm explained the crafty ways black men avoided military service, recounting his own experience evading the draft during World War II. In June 1943, when he was scheduled for induction, Malcolm made sure that Army officials thought that he was mentally unstable. He showed up, costumed like an actor, wearing a zoot suit, his hair frazzled into a reddish bush of conch. At the reception desk, he ran his mouth, talking nothing but jive, addressing a white officer as Daddy-O. Finally, a man in a white coat pulled him out of the induction line and sent him to see a military psychiatrist. He appeared incredibly paranoid, rambling and whipping his head around as if somebody was spying on him. Suddenly, he bolted from his seat and peered beneath the door. Then he whispered into the psychiatrist's ear, "I want to get down south, organize them nigger soldiers, you dig? Steal us some guns and kill us some crackers." A few months later, Malcolm's performance earned him a 4F classification, mentally disqualified for duty. When they arrived at the UN, Malcolm and the Clay brothers had brunch with Simeon O. Adebo, an ambassador from Nigeria. Adebo thanked Cassius for befriending Nigerian boxer Dick Tiger and invited him to visit his country. Adebo also encouraged him to accept the responsibilities that came with being a champion recognized by black people all over the world. "You are not now what you were before the fight," he said. As the champion of the world, Adebo advised, he possessed cultural power, the kind of power that could unify black people, in the name of world brotherhood. As Cassius walked out of the UN, a reporter from the New York Times spotted him and asked a few questions. When he said that his new name was Cassius X. Clay, the writer inquired if the X had replaced his middle name. "X is what the slave masters used to be called," Cassius answered, making an obvious error. Malcolm clearly had more teaching to do. He elbowed Cassius, suggesting that they should end the interview. Elijah seethed when he learned that Malcolm had escorted Cassius to the UN again. He knew that his former minister was out to destroy him but he refused to let Malcolm snatch Cassius Clay away from him. Since he called Cassius on the eve of the Liston fight, the boxer had ignored his warnings against socializing with Malcolm. Perhaps Cassius did not fully understand what was at stake, or maybe Malcolm had persuaded him that everything was fine. After Cassius returned from the UN, Elijah called him at the Teresa and made clear that he could no longer associate with the exiled minister. Cassius understood, promising that he would stop seeing Malcolm, starting today. Torn between his friendship with Malcolm and his faith in Muhammad, Cassius wavered. He admired both men, but he was confused by Malcolm's behavior. What no one knew was that Malcolm had told him something that he just could not believe. For nearly 2 years, he'd taught Cassius that Muhammad was Allah's messenger, the most powerful black man in America. Nearly every lesson began with, "The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us." Yet on or around the day of their second visit to the UN, Malcolm told Cassius and Rudy that Elijah was a false prophet who had lied and abused his power. He probably also revealed that Muhammad had impregnated numerous secretaries. When Rudy heard Malcolm talk such blasphemy, he wrestled him to the floor until Cassius pulled them apart. Malcolm's allegations made Cassius question his friend's motives. It made him wonder why Malcolm was staying so close to him all the time. Malcolm had a good reason to attach himself to Cassius. About a week earlier, when he returned from Miami, Malcolm had learned that Captain Joseph had contacted a soldier in the FOI. During a private conversation outside the nation's Harlem luncheonette, Joseph gave Luckman X a deadly assignment. Plant a bomb in Malcolm's 63 Oldsmobile that will take care of him. Suspicious of Joseph's instructions, Luckman wondered why he did not follow the chain of command and deliver the message to one of his lieutenants, as he normally did. Joseph never gave direct orders to the fruit. The assignment made Luckman uneasy. He had long admired Malcolm for protesting police brutality. Skeptical of Joseph, he shared the assassination plot with Malcolm, forcing him to finally accept that his life with the nation was over. "I knew they didn't intend to reinstate me as a Muslim," he said later. "You don't point a shotgun at somebody who's suspended." Hours after he left Cassius and Rudy at the Teresa, Malcolm turned up the volume on his car radio when he heard the voice of Elijah on WWRL. Over a nationwide broadcast, Muhammad announced that the name Cassius Clay has no divine meaning. "I hope he will accept being called by a better name. Muhammad Ali is what I will give to him, as long as he believes in Allah and follows me." Malcolm erupted behind the wheel, shouting to one of his aides, "That's political! That's a political move! He did it to prevent him from coming with me!" In the past, the boxer had professed great admiration for his name. It was hard for him to imagine being anyone other than Cassius Clay. Knowing that there were lifelong members in the nation who never received their original names from Elijah made him doubt that he had earned such an honor. But the messenger reminded him that his original name meant one who is worthy of praise, and no one was more deserving of the distinction than him. Cassius instinctively knew that the internecine fighting between Elijah and Malcolm had escalated to a critical, violent stage. He had heard stories about Muslims who crossed Muhammad and paid severely for it. Malcolm himself had once told him, "Nobody leaves the Muslims without trouble." Now, he had a choice to make. If he accepted the name Elijah gave him, would it end the brotherhood with Malcolm? If he rejected Elijah's overture, would it cost him his life? Politics, he was discovering, was more dangerous than fighting Sonny Liston. Ultimately, he submitted to Elijah. When he denounced his slave name and accepted the name Muhammad Ali, he symbolically broke with a heritage tied to bondage. It signified an awakening, a reclamation of freedom from the white world. But it also cut his ties with Malcolm. Instinctively, more than intellectually, he understood the choice he had to make. And as he had so often before, he chose the less dangerous path. When he was Cassius Clay, he had said, "I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free to be what I want to be." Yet that was never really true. There were limits to his new freedom. If he had remained friends with Malcolm, he would have fallen out of favor with Elijah and would have been forever known as Cassius Clay. But when he chose Elijah over Malcolm, Elijah determined who he wanted him to be, and that was Muhammad Ali, a devout Muslim and his loyal subject. Once Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali, Elijah won his political chess match with Malcolm. When Malcolm heard Elijah's radio address, Clay had not yet publicly announced that he had accepted the Muslim name, but it did not matter to Malcolm. When Malcolm lost the contest for Clay's loyalty, he had no more moves, no more pawns to sacrifice. At that moment, Malcolm was expendable. At that moment, his life was in jeopardy. Malcolm was sinking fast, like a man drowning in quicksand. Hearing Elijah's announcement over the radio elevated his heartbeat. In a panic, he telephoned the Boxer suite. A voice on the other end of the line told him that Clay was not taking his calls. Elijah had already assigned members of the Fruit to guard his most prized possession. The Muslims around the Boxer spoke with one voice. Malcolm was a liar and a traitor. Dejected, Malcolm hung up the phone, without ever speaking to his friend. Malcolm's mistake was that he believed Cassius would see the world through his eyes. If he spent enough time with Cassius, he thought, he could prove that he had his best interests in mind, and perhaps their brotherhood would become stronger than Clay's allegiance to Elijah. He had hoped that he could mold Clay's combative boxing instincts into fighting for black freedom outside the ring. But unlike Malcolm, at his core, Cassius was never comfortable with the politics of confrontation. He had said again and again that he was afraid of what would happen if he joined a demonstration or a sit-in. He felt far more secure within the nation, where he was constantly praised for simply being who he was, a boxer. Malcolm never wielded the same power over him that Elijah Muhammad did. How could he? Clay's vision of Elijah Muhammad was a product of Malcolm's creation. Part man, part prophet, all-powerful and all-knowing. Cassius respected authority, and there was no higher authority, Malcolm said, than the messenger. Although he admired Malcolm, he viewed him as only Muhammad's representative. When Malcolm belatedly challenged Muhammad's sovereignty, he became a castaway in a lifeboat, drifting in the wrong direction. Elijah, on the other hand, was the emperor of an entire kingdom, and now Cassius had become his shining new prince. Elijah also offered him something that Malcolm could not, the love of a father. The nation, Jerry Eisenberg observed, became Clay's family, even to the extent that he was able to bring his brother into it, and Elijah Muhammad became his father. Yet he seldom let anyone get too close. Few ever really knew, as Malcolm thought he did, the man who became Muhammad Ali. Over the course of his career, people moved in and out of his life as if they were walking through a revolving door. Friends, promoters, hustlers, entrepreneurs, accountants, agents, lawyers, and women came and went. Cassius built a wall around himself in the form of an entourage, hiring men with fake titles whose only job was to take care of him. As long as they served his needs, as long as Cassius did not have to worry about anything or anyone, they remained in his life. He willingly allowed older men to take charge of his life. He did not need another brother or best friend. Rudy filled those roles. Searching for a father figure, he found security in the hands of patriarchs, whether a boxing trainer like Angelo Dundee, the members of the Louisville sponsoring group, or Elijah Muhammad. Ceding his life to Elijah, though, reveals a certain irony. It was Clay's father who laid the groundwork for the boy becoming a Muslim, Gordon Davidson explained. Clay Sr. frequently told his sons not to trust white men and warned them about the dangers of integration. He claimed that he had Arabian features and, like Elijah, prophesied about the Day of Judgment. "It's the end of times," he often ranted. "We're in the last days, the last days." Clay Sr., who was not a devout Christian, claimed that he read the Bible closely and that he knew that only Christians would survive the resurrection. Those Muslims, he said, would incur God's wrath. Listening to him and Elijah, one could hardly tell them apart. The champ was in no mood to deal with his father. On Saturday, March 7th, Cassius and Rudy arrived at Standiford Field, where nearly 400 people, including the Louisville mayor, welcomed him home. At the airfield, he met with reporters, fans, and family, who all expected him to arrive with a boyish grin, bold boasting, and comic attempts at poetry. The public expected an entertainer, but the champ was not interested. When his father tried to crown him with a golden papier-mâché coronet, scarlet cloak, and scepter, Cassius, looking visibly agitated, pulled away and said, "I don't want any of that stuff." His father didn't let up, pestering him again until he finally posed for photographers, wearing the royal costume, with a frown. Clay fidgeted throughout his press conference, appearing uncomfortable with the entire affair. Rubbing his eyes, he complained that he was tired and just wanted to go home. After answering a few questions, he signed autographs using the name that people had always recognized. Elijah Muhammad may have given him a new name, but he had not yet fully embraced it. "I plan to fight under the name Cassius Clay, unless," he said, "I'm ordered not to." During his stay in Louisville, he visited a local radio station, answering questions from listeners. A nervous boy called and addressed the champ, "Cassius?" The champ replied, "Cassius speaking." He did not correct the young fan for failing to use his Muslim name or denounce his slave name. He did not deliver a harangue about integration or sermonize about the wisdom of Elijah Muhammad. His fans in Louisville did not want to hear him hollering about the Nation of Islam. They wanted to hear from their hometown hero. When a caller suggested that he should boast less and show more humility, Cassius surprised the man with a clever lesson. "Well, you keep this in your books," he said. "A wise man can act a fool, but a fool cannot act a wise man." Stunned, the caller did not know what he had just heard. "Uh-huh," he said. Impressed, the show's host, Milton Metz, said, "That's pretty good. Where's that quotation from?" "Oh, that's something I figured out," Clay replied. "Sounds like Shakespeare." Cassius laughed. "Might be. I heard it somewhere." He knew exactly where he had heard the maxim. He had been reciting it ever since he fought Henry Cooper in London. Now, about a week after he said that he had fallen in love with Malcolm, watching him debate on television, he could not even utter his friend's name on the radio. Chapter 14. An American Nightmare. The Negro has long since learned that his real heroes are always depicted as villains by the white world. Liberator. America was unprepared for the name Muhammad Ali. Seldom had a man's new name mattered so much to so many. He was not the first boxer to change his name. Countless other fighters changed their names too, many the sons of immigrants who willingly adopted a new identity to make themselves more acceptable, more marketable, and more American. But none, until Muhammad Ali, chose a name that was freighted with such racial and political meaning. Fight fans, promoters, and sports writers had no problems using the other aliases, yet for political reasons, many refused to say the name Muhammad Ali. It sounded too foreign and too subversive. Skeptical of his sincerity, the Chicago Tribune printed an editorial assailing his religious beliefs. "It needs to be made quite clear that the Islam which heavyweight champion Cassius Clay has adopted is a far, far cry from the religion practiced in the Arab world." Mocking Ali, columnist Jim Murray referred to him as Abdul the Bulbul Amir. Sonny Liston dismissed the champ's new name, too. Ahmed Mali, Mahmoud Wali, who's that? I met you as Cassius Clay, and I'll leave you as Cassius Clay. Recognizing the champ's Muslim name would have meant accepting Ali's freedom to define himself, a freedom that many whites, and even some blacks, were unwilling to acknowledge. For the crusty, cigar-chomping crowd of old-school reporters, Red Smith, Dan Parker, Dick Young, Arthur Daly, and Jimmy Cannon, Ali was a national disgrace, the scourge of American sports. Cannon could not hide his disgust for Ali. He wrote, "I pity Clay and abhor what he represents." The black Muslims, he insisted, were exploiting Clay, the same way that the communists used famous people during the Great Depression. Now that Ali had become champion, boxing, Cannon feared, had reached its nadir. The fight racket, since its rotten beginnings, has been the red light district of sports. But, he lamented, this is the first time it has been turned into an instrument of mass hate. At a time when minorities held half of the major division boxing titles, it appeared that black and brown men dominated the entire sport. The days when boxing made white men rich and black men cripples were long gone. White writers and white fans lamented the loss of an era. Whites, they said, never got a shot at the heavyweight title anymore. It seemed that the black man had taken over everything, the cities, the streets, the old neighborhoods, even sports. More blacks could be seen on television playing baseball, basketball, and football. And now the black man was taking over boxing, too. Now that the Equal Opportunity Movement has brought such an improvement to the lot of the Negro, Dan Parker asked, when are the white heavyweights going to start picketing the weighing-in scales at boxing commission offices for the same deal? The moment Ali defeated Liston, sports writers and politicians revived their campaign to abolish boxing. In the greatest uproar since the death of Benny Perrette, moralists demanded an investigation into the sport, questioning the legitimacy of Ali's victory. The odors of the Clay Liston thing continue to assail the nostrils, Arthur Daly wrote. Weeks after the match, Daly and other writers were still stunned that Liston had lost. Ali had looked unimpressive during his training camp, Daly argued, but overnight became transformed into a clever fighter. And Liston, usually an indomitable force, was unrecognizable, sitting on his stool by the end of the sixth round. Conspiracy theorists suspected that Ali had won the match for only one reason: the fight was fixed. They said that Ali had wanted to quit the fight, but his corner would not let him. They said that Liston wanted to continue, but his corner would not let him either. That was why Liston, considered the toughest man in the game, complained that his injured shoulder prevented him from continuing. And, of course, Sonny had ties to organized crime. But the most damning evidence, critics claimed, was that before the fight, Ali had signed a contract with Liston's promotional agency for $50,000, guaranteeing International Promotions the right to name the new champion's first opponent in a title defense. Ed Lastman, president of the World Boxing Association, WBA, insisted that the agreement violated their rules on return bouts, despite knowing all about the arrangement before the match. Since Liston was president of International Promotions, Lastman argued, he stood to benefit financially from a rematch with Ali, even though boxers often held a stake in promotional agencies. There was no real evidence of a betting conspiracy involving Liston or Ali. Bookmakers insisted that the smart money was bet on Liston, and the gambling odds against Ali actually increased from 7-1 to 8-1 on the day of the match. If the fight was fixed for Ali to win, why did he beg Dundee to end the fight? If the fight was fixed for Liston to lose, why did he try to blind Ali? Every conspiracy theory about the fight crumbles under the weight of inconsistencies. Despite the lack of any evidence against the champ, Lastman announced that the WBA would vacate Ali's title because his behavior as champion was detrimental to the boxing world. Joining the black Muslims, Lastman contended, made Ali a very poor example for the youth of the world. The WBA's commissioner, Abe Green, echoed his sentiment. Clay should be given the chance to decide whether he wants to be a religious crusader or the heavyweight champion, he said. None of the most influential state athletic commissions supported the WBA's endorsement, and after a few days of hearings in front of the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly, there was still no evidence that Ali or Liston had done anything illegal. The subcommittee recommended passing a bill that would create a federal boxing czar who would oversee the sport, but the proposal never materialized. Facing strong opposition, Lastman ended his campaign against the champ. Still, Arthur Daly maintained that the WBA's abortive efforts were inconsequential. Boxing, he wrote, is beyond redemption. It should be abolished. For many critics, the future of the sport remained in doubt, but one thing was certain. Muhammad Ali was not the savior that Cassius Clay had been. Muhammad Ali had made a world of enemies. While white critics denounced his membership in the Nation of Islam, blacks debated his relationship with the Muslims. Some feared that he would exploit his position as champion to recruit young blacks into the sect. Proclaiming his belief in separatism, Ali had created more apprehension among middle-class integrationist blacks than Malcolm X. Black writers, entertainers, and activists compared his views to those espoused by the Ku Klux Klan, the White Citizens' Councils, and the Dixiecrats. When Cassius Clay joined the black Muslims and started calling himself Cassius X, Martin Luther King charged, he became the champion of racial segregation, and that is what we are fighting. Joe Louis, considered the greatest heavyweight champion of all time, beloved by blacks and whites alike, declared that he would never cheer for the Muslim champ. Clay will earn the public's hatred because of his connections with the black Muslims, he told reporters. The things they preach are just the opposite of what we believe. What we believe. Louis and many black Americans insisted that Ali no longer represented the race. He was an outsider, condemned for rejecting the ideals of the civil rights movement. Ali disappointed many blacks because he rejected the traditional responsibilities associated with being heavyweight champion. In a xenophobic outburst, Floyd Patterson condemned Ali as unfit to be a champion. He accused him of being ignorant of the black Muslims' ideology and confused about their real goals. Ali might just as well have joined the Ku Klux Klan, he charged. There was only one thing left for Patterson to do. Save boxing from Muhammad Ali and the Nation of Islam. The good Catholic fighter challenged Cassius X to a holy war, announcing that he would fight him any time, anywhere, even though the ninth-ranked heavyweight was in no position to proclaim himself a title contender. In his self-righteousness, Patterson made himself out to be more patriotic than Ali, a purer champion, and a better citizen. "I am an American," he declared, implying that Ali was not as long as he belonged to the Nation of Islam. Ali dismissed Patterson's challenge. If anyone was exploiting boxing, he retorted, it was Patterson. The only reason he's decided to come out of his shell now is to try to make himself a big hero to the white man by saving the heavyweight title from being held by a Muslim. When Patterson attacked Ali's religion, the champion said that he might as well have been attacking Cairo, Egypt, the holy city of Mecca, Pakistan, Turkey, and 300,000 Muslim Americans. In defense of Islam, he began to see himself not just as an American, but also as a global citizen, a guardian of all Muslims. The feud between Patterson and Ali demonstrated that the backlash against the Muslim champ was as much about Islamophobia as it was about race. During the Cold War, many Americans linked Islam to the Middle East and Africa, a region perceived as backward, brutal, and politically oppressive. The vitriol aimed at Ali, therefore, derived from Americans who considered Islam a destructive alternative to Christianity, and from fears that the Middle East had succumbed to the influence of the Soviet Union. Americans' stereotypical views of the region as an endless sand trap filled with genies, harems, sultans, sheiks, and camel-riding nomads influenced their views of Ali. In a satirical column, Jim Murray portrayed him as the Sheik of Araby, fighting against infidels. I think Cassius sees himself as Lawrence of Arabia or the Red Shadow, rather than a guy licking stamps for hate literature, he wrote. Cassius has always had a lively imagination, and it was only a question of time before he'd wrap a towel around his head and begin to play Saladin the Saracen. I expect him to trade in his Cadillac for a camel any day now. Jackie Robinson did not use Ali's Muslim name, but he recognized his right to practice Islam. Clay has just as much right to ally himself with the Muslim religion as anyone else has to be a Protestant or a Catholic, he wrote in his syndicated column. Robinson cautioned that there was no reason to think thousands of blacks would follow Ali because he had joined the nation. Too many blacks had marched, fought, and bled for freedom to join a separatist movement, he argued. While most black Americans rejected the theology of the nation, many identified with Ali's politics of self-determination. Young urban blacks viewed his resistance to white authority through the prism of their own struggle for empowerment and freedom. Jill Nelson, a writer who grew up in Harlem during the 1960s, recalled, "We weren't about to join the nation, but we loved Ali for that supreme act of defiance. It was the defiance against having to be the good Negro, the good Christian, waiting to be rewarded by the righteous white provider." Nelson and black youths across the country loved Ali for many reasons: his racial pride, his outspokenness, his independent attitude. But most of all, she said, they loved Ali because he epitomized a lot of black people's emotions at the time: our anger, our sense of entitlement, the need to be better just to get to the median, the sense of standing up to the furies. Facing an onslaught of criticism, Ali stood his ground, refusing to retreat from his beliefs. When Americans challenged his religious freedom, he began to question America. He was tired of hearing that he should show more restraint and dignity. He could not understand why people hated him just for being a Muslim. "People are always telling me what a good example I could be if I just wasn't a Muslim," he said. "I've heard it over and over. How come I couldn't be like Joe Louis and Sugar Ray?" "Well, they're gone now, and the black man's condition is just the same, ain't it? We're still catching hell." "It's going to be different now," Malcolm explained to New York Times writer Mike Handler. "I'm going to join the fight wherever Negroes ask for my help, and I suspect my activities will be on a greater and more intensive scale than in the past." The past. It's where Malcolm wanted to leave Elijah Muhammad and the nation, but he could not break away from them. Not as long as he lived. On Sunday, March 8th, he drove to Handler's home and told him that he no longer represented Muhammad and the nation. In the interest of peace, he advised all black Muslims to continue following Elijah, even though a group of confidants from his old mosque had already joined him. The front page of the next day's edition of The Times included Handler's story, headlined, "Malcolm X Splits with Muhammad." He addressed his plans for the future: building a black nationalist political party, organizing a voting campaign, speaking at college campuses, and working with civil rights groups. All activities Elijah had discouraged. Around the same time, he started talking more about armed self-defense and purchased a semi-automatic rifle. If he wished to broker peace with Muhammad, he showed no restraint in blaming him for turning their dispute into a blood feud. When Handler asked why he was leaving Muhammad's side, he answered, "Envy blinds men and makes it impossible for them to think clearly. This is what happened." Malcolm, Elijah had declared, was a hypocrite, a word with a special meaning among the black Muslims. In the nation, a hypocrite was the most hated by God. Elijah preached, "They are double-crossers. They come in claiming belief and then go out disbelieving." These wicked, evil-tongued people who deceived Allah and deviated from his messenger would suffer Allah's wrath. A hypocrite like Malcolm was the enemy, and Allah would show him no mercy, Elijah warned. On the Sunday that Malcolm spoke to Handler, Elijah sent Louis X to preach at Mosque No. 7 in Harlem. In a subsequent phone conversation, Elijah praised Louis for his good work replacing the exiled minister, though merely mentioning Malcolm's name aroused Elijah's anger. It was time to make an example of that no-good long-legged Malcolm, he exclaimed. Hypocrites like him could only be dealt with one way. You cut their heads off. Elijah also stayed in close contact with his son Herbert, whom he had selected to manage Ali. He told Herbert that he wanted to meet with Ali in Chicago to ensure that the boxer had severed ties with Malcolm. He also wanted to discuss Ali's upcoming trip abroad because the young fellow needed to learn how to behave when he met with statesmen. He worried that Ali had never been out of the country, which was untrue, revealing how little he actually knew about the boxer's career. Elijah instructed Herbert not to let Ali make any plans with anyone until they met. Finally, he advised, add 4 more pages to our paper so that the whole world could read about the famous Muslim champion. On Monday, March 9th, Muhammad telephoned Captain Joseph and declared that Malcolm must give up everything that belonged to the Nation of Islam, including his home. Joseph sent word to Maceo X, the secretary of the New York Mosque, to draft an eviction letter. That same day, Herbert's assistant called Malcolm to inform him that Elijah's son would now serve as Ali's manager and that Ali no longer planned to travel abroad with him. Malcolm fumed. He was the one who introduced Ali to African ambassadors. He was the one who had convinced Ali that he should embrace a larger role on the world stage and develop relationships with African leaders. He was the one who had strategically planned for Ali to visit Muslim countries in Africa and the Middle East, and now the black Muslims had stolen his friend and his plan. But Malcolm was not ready to give up on Ali yet. Desperate to reach him, he telephoned Ali 8 times that day, but he could not get through the men who surrounded the champ. In a phone interview, Ali told a reporter from the Amsterdam News that he still intended to tour Africa, but added, "I will not be traveling with Malcolm X." After Malcolm announced his official break from the Nation, more reporters called Ali to learn about his future. He said that he disagreed with Malcolm's sanguinary rhetoric. "I am against violence," the boxer said. "I am a fighter, and I am religious, but I am not going to do anything that is not right. I don't know much about what Malcolm X is doing, but I do know that Muhammad is the wisest." In front of newsmen at his Phoenix home, Muhammad wept, feigning disbelief over Malcolm's departure. "I am stunned," he professed. "I never dreamed this man would deviate from the Nation of Islam. Every one of the Muslims admired him." Muhammad's tears gave the impression that Malcolm had left the Nation under his own free will. Acting deserted and betrayed, Muhammad seemed to grieve the loss of a man whom he once considered his own flesh and blood, the same man that he had blamed for poisoning the Nation with lies about him. That same afternoon, March 10th, Captain Joseph, Maceo X, and a squad from the Fruit showed up at Malcolm's East Elmhurst home on 97th Street in Queens. Joseph served Malcolm with eviction papers and demanded that he surrender some of the mosque's valuables. Malcolm handed over a few documents and securities from the Nation's treasury, but he refused to leave the house. Muhammad had once told him that the house was his, even though the deed showed that the home was the legal property of the Nation of Islam. The moment Captain Joseph showed up at his doorstep, Malcolm regretted ever taking a vow of poverty and determined that he would fight back. Malcolm knew that this was only the beginning. The war had just begun. "They've got to kill me," he told a reporter. "They can't afford to let me live." On Thursday, March 12th, around 10 a.m., a sleek black Chrysler pulled up to the curb in front of the Midtown Park Sheraton Hotel. Malcolm stepped out of the car, wearing a pearl-gray pin-checked suit and carrying a briefcase. A cadre of black men followed him inside, through the noisy lobby and up to the packed second-floor tapestry suite, where a crowd of reporters, photographers, and undercover FBI agents waited for him. Before he stepped to the podium, his aides distributed press releases announcing his split from the NOI and the creation of Muslim Mosque Inc., MMI, a politically oriented nationalist group of Muslims and secularists. Malcolm looked fried after a week of sleepless nights. Before he began speaking, he managed to smile, nodding at some of the reporters he recognized. Then he offered a chilling prelude to a long, hot summer in Harlem. "Because 1964 threatens to be a very explosive year on the racial front, in fact, it would be one of the most violent in American history, and because I myself intend to be very active in every phase of the Negro struggle for human rights, I have called this press conference this morning to clarify my own position in the struggle." In careful language, he advised blacks to purchase guns, form rifle clubs, and defend themselves by any means necessary. Malcolm offered only a vague description about the objectives of MMI, as he was not entirely sure of his own direction. He had said that whites were welcome to support his organization, but they could not join. There could be no unity between blacks and whites until blacks had unified themselves. And although he still rejected the goals and tactics of civil rights leaders, he claimed that he wanted to cooperate with those leaders, whom he had once derided as Uncle Toms. The media focused most of its attention on Malcolm's self-defense rhetoric, characterizing his message in simple, violent terms. Malcolm had never sounded so dangerous, writers fretted. Elijah Muhammad assured a New York Times writer that Malcolm was not nearly as threatening as the press made him sound. His former minister had no following, no guns, and no divine authority. Malcolm's plan sounded silly to him. Where are they going to get guns and arms? In the wake of Malcolm's press conference, black Americans debated his future in the freedom struggle. Bayard Rustin suggested that most blacks would never consider creating a separate state or migrating back to Africa, but they accepted Malcolm's analysis of the evils that are being practiced on the Negro people, and that could make him a potent leader. In appearance, personality, and philosophical outlook, a sepia writer opined, Malcolm comes closer to being a revolutionary than any other American Negro leader. Liberator's Carlos Russell agreed. He found Malcolm charismatic and persuasive, but the nationalist minister provided more slogans than answers to the black man's problems. If Malcolm ever developed an effective program, he would indeed become the most formidable leader black people have ever known. Freed from Elijah Muhammad's authority, many wondered if Malcolm had changed. Who was this independent Malcolm X? Was he a demagogue or a revolutionary? Was he merely an orator, or would he actually fight for freedom? Did he really hate white people, or did he simply hate the injustices that he had witnessed? Dick Shop sought the answers when he visited with Malcolm at the Hotel Teresa. When the Muslim minister welcomed the Jewish reporter into his office, Shop realized that Malcolm was nothing like the frightening agitator that he had read about. Malcolm was surprisingly friendly. "It is almost impossible, upon meeting him, not to like him," he wrote. In private, other white writers learned that Malcolm did not love the white man, but he did not necessarily hate him either. "There were two Malcolms, really," said Mike Handler, one of the few white journalists whose home Malcolm had visited. "There was the private Malcolm, a man of ineffable charm and courtesy, a born aristocrat. And there was the public Malcolm, Malcolm in combat, whose job it was to frighten the white man out of his shoes." Shop departed Malcolm's office with a new perspective, yet he remained frustrated. Malcolm had avoided most of his questions, repeating old lines and delivering verbose answers. He left wondering if Malcolm would ever lead when action was needed. "No one really knows the extent of his power because he has never put his power to any real test." But he could not dismiss Malcolm either. He was too eloquent and too intelligent to be ignored. Trying to figure out Malcolm X, he concluded, was as difficult as cracking a secret code. It is a game that almost every thinking person in Harlem is playing these days.
And that will wrap things up for our first audio segment. Context of White Supremacy, Blood Brothers, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, the co-authors. If you have a commentary you would like to share, feel free to chime in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We are still in chapter 14, kind of close to the end of chapter 14. That's where we'll pick up at for the second audio segment. If you would like to participate, but you don't want to use your phone to dial in, you can use the free VOPE line. It's connected, or linked rather, at the Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, that address is tinytiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page, you'll see the link. It says free vote line. Click it, it will open a small window on your screen. First line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do that, you'll hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. Do so. Once you do that, we will see your hand on the screen, add you to the conversation. Again, our server was updated at Black Talk Radio Network. So for people, anyone, if you listened to the program via TuneIn, if you listen to the live broadcast there, it might not be working. It is taking the whites at TuneIn some time to update to the new server. Once that happens, then you'll be able to listen there either to the live content or archived content as usual. In the meantime, you can certainly listen live at Black Talk Radio Network. You'll see the player right on the page. The link is on the Facebook page. It's on Twitter. Very easy to access, and it is on autoplay. So as soon as you hit the page for the Context of White Supremacy at Black Talk Radio Network, it will begin playing. If you get confused, have problems, feel free to drop an email. Let us know. With that, we will nab folks who dialed in. Again, if you have commentary, star 6, and we'll get you on the line. Folks who dialed in with a hand up thus far, your line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Tommy Hurt?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Doc. Good evening to all the callers. Thomas Smith in New York. No, I want to know, Gus, because I don't have the book. Is this part about Ali looking for a father figure and all of that, is that in quotes, or is that the author's thoughts?
Might take me a second to flip back to get the exact page. I do remember that portion of the book to see if that's in quotes.
Yeah, I was just wondering because it sounds like, you know, something that white people would say, you know, figure he's looking for a father figure. That's why he surrounds himself with all these older gentlemen and doesn't make decisions for himself. And Elijah reminds him of his father.
Okay. The paragraph, it says, he willingly allowed older men to take charge of his life. He did not need another brother or best friend. Rudy filled those roles. That's his brother. Searching for a father figure, he found security in the hands of patriarchs, whether a boxing trainer like Angelo Dundee, the members of the Louisville sponsoring group, or Elijah Muhammad. Ceding his life to Elijah, though, reveals a certain irony. Let's see. Whoops. Lost my page. It was Clay's father who laid the groundwork for the boy becoming a Muslim. Gordon Davidson explained Clay Sr. frequently told his sons not to trust white men and warned them about the dangers of integration. It goes from there. That portion right there is the only part that is actually in quotes where he's quoting Gordon Davidson's comment about Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay's father laying the groundwork for him to becoming a member of the Nation of Islam. This is according to Gordon Davidson. But everything else is not in quotes. It's not footnoted. It's all the author's words about him looking for security in the hands of patriarchs.
Yeah, I figured that because I think, you know, they view us as kids and, you know, always looking for a father. And they also added Angelo Dundee in there. And I said, the white savior. That's what I thought. Also, you know, they made reference to the Hotel Lorraine. And one of the, I always say, you know, I thought, and I could be wrong, and I didn't live in that period, but under the period of segregation, you know, we owned our own businesses. So, you know, here you have this whole black-owned hotel in the middle of Harlem where dignitaries go and all the stars had to go because, you know, they probably didn't feel as welcome downtown or wasn't allowed there. And, you know, that provided a lot of jobs and things. I mean, it's a huge building. It's still there. Now it's owned by Columbia University. But they do some Columbia Medical School teachers out of there. But beautiful building. You know, you can tell it's old. You know, now, you know, like I said, it's not owned by black people anymore, partly because of integration. But, you know, I just thought of that you know, I've always passed it, and one day someone told me about it, and I looked it up, and I was intrigued by it because I passed every day and never would have thought that a black man once owned it. And I meet my mom.
Other folks have commentary they would like to share.
Greetings, Gus. How are you? This is Ross.
Greetings.
Yes, I'm going to be chiming in on the second half because I missed too much of the first half of the reading, but I wanted to make sure I got my hands up early. I didn't want to wait and, you know, potentially not get the opportunity to speak. So I just wanted to, and I might chime in based on what I hear other callers say, what I hear. So thank you for taking my call, and I'll definitely be chiming in on the second half of the reading.
For sure. We'll nab other hands as I see them. We only have two sessions left, and we'll be wrapping this one up kind of on the home stretch, so folks should be thinking of concluding comments, lasting impressions, overall themes that you will take away from the text, because we are closing in on the end of the book. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, you all have commentary you want to share?
Good evening, guests. Good evening to all the other callers and listeners. This is Karma. I have to say, I was just monitoring my emotional roller coaster during this reading. I just, you know, I was just so mad at the Nation of Islam. I was just so mad. I don't know. It's just so mad at the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I was like, God, you're just being just a, you know, dictatorial, like every other pastor and every other church You know, it's like, I will either send you to heaven or I will send you to hell. And my anger is just, it was just escalating with every word. My sympathies with Minister Malcolm were just growing more and more and more. All right, and I said, well, okay, so what's going on here? So, I mean, I've never met Minister Malcolm. My only interaction with the Nation of Islam was they left me standing out in the rain like a yard ornament, but whatever. So, but what I think it is just like whenever a black charismatic leader dies, well, he's safely in the grave. It's okay to make that person go ahead and say he was a saint. We loved him greatly. He really had a lot to offer. Too bad he's dead. It's those other Negroes who did it. They're the ones to blame. And they're still alive. That religion, the Nation of Islam is still up and running. It's a very visible organization. They have much to say, and they're still just a bunch of sorry people. And I think that is that is being done deliberately, and I think it's been done before. And I think my emotions are being manipulated in this book to really despise the organization that is still viable and still capable of doing things, and then go ahead and, you know, make the person who's you know, dead and gone, that was a saint. They could have done no wrong. They would have been fantastic. Too bad those black people just, you know, killed them. And I think that's what's going on. I think I'm being manipulated. I feel like I'm being manipulated. And I just thought I would get that out there. I don't know if anyone else is feeling the same way.
Interesting. We'll get feedback on that as well. All of folks that we have not heard from yet, that you all had a commentary you wanted to share as well, should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks for taking the call, Gus. Moving to the other callers on the line. I just wanted to chime in. It's reading like Mr. Elijah Muhammad was more of a gangster, more so than a religious leader. And I'm just basing that off of what I'm reading. I think he ordered Tang down to put a car bomb under his car. And that was very disturbing. I know that whites are most to blame for, I guess, what took place. But just based on the reading, I feel where the caller is coming from. Getting familiar with Malcolm X, more so, you know, what he was all about. And it's very discouraging to watch the deterioration of the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm. And, yeah, now I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure, for sure. If other folks have commentary they would like to share, feel free to chime in if you are so inclined. There were quite a few interesting notes within this week's reading. If you kind of check the reference section to see where they're quoting from, they had a quote from the New York Times, Feud Within the Black Muslims by Gertrude Samuels. This is from March 22nd, 1964. They had a letter to Muhammad Ali, which is pretty interesting as well. I was kind of checking that out during the reading also. This is by Shelby St. Cor. This is also 1964. And then he had a quote from the book, Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight, that kind of gives more of the detail about when Muhammad Ali, I guess, officially, publicly, was a member of the Nation of Islam, and him getting the name Muhammad Ali and all that. They have some interesting passages from there. I have to see if I can read a paragraph quickly from any of these before moving forward. But you should be able to track down any of this stuff online if you are so interested in doing some more digging about what was in this week's first section of the reading. Some of the first things that stood out in the reading, the paragraph where he says, this is pretty early in what we read this week, what they said, the authors, Mr. Roberts, Mr. Smith, in a moment of weakness, he exploited his friendship, talking about Minister Malcolm, with Clay, manipulating him and withholding the truth about his future in the nation. In a desperate attempt to prove his value to Elijah, he offered to deliver Clay to Chicago after the title fight, treating Cassius like some prize that could be bartered or traded. But Elijah did not have to buy Clay's loyalty. He already owned it. Now, there is a footnote at the conclusion of this paragraph where they cite a newspaper article. I think this is Chicago Tribune. None of this is in quotes, so this is their assessment. They do have a secret conference, in quote, that's kind of at the beginning of the paragraph between Clay and Minister Malcolm at that time. But we talked about this last week, and we read some of the different sources that they cited in the book, where other people talk about Minister Malcolm hoping that he could present Muhammad, or Cassius Clay at the time, he could present him at the Savior's Day meeting in 1964, right after, days after he defeated Sonny Liston, won the championship, and that this might help get him back in. But other people had a very different reading. Even other white authors had a very different analysis. They wrote about this in a very different manner, not implying that this was some sort of devious, selfish scheme that he could dupe Minister Malcolm, to dupe Cassius Clay and just use him for his own personal gain. I think, at least in my view, I think the way that that has been presented consistently throughout the text, in the way that they are presenting it, I think is an act of racism and might even to some degree challenge. I don't really get the impression that very many black people at all come through looking too favorable in this book. I don't. At least I do not get the impression that we're to see Minister Malcolm very favorable either. That he's just spewing rhetoric. That he doesn't really have a plan. That he's just, you know, self-interest and manipulating Cassius Clay. That, you know, maybe he cares about him, maybe he doesn't, but he's willing to manipulate him too to save his own hide and get back in with his organization. That's kind of the presentation that I think we are getting of Minister Malcolm. I don't think anybody gets off, any black people come off looking too well in this book at all. The next portion that I looked at, I just made note because this was from the Half Has Never Been Told book we read way, way back, beginning of the year. I think our caller down in Florida, he questioned whether or not Cassius Clay was aware that his namesake was a racist white man who enslaved black people. And I said, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, did not strike me as a dumb person. I'm pretty sure he probably knew. And once again, we get confirmation that he was aware of that. The next portion where it says Clay was unaware how he would express his new freedom now that he was champion of the world. And the world knew that he was a Muslim. Only a few months earlier, he told the Louisville sponsoring group that he no longer wanted to be a showman. He was not interested in being a clown on television. He'd said that he wanted people to take him more seriously. But now his representatives at the William Morris Agency were in the middle of negotiating a deal involving millions of dollars where he would perform on television, on tour, and on more records. It was an enticing offer that made him reconsider his position. Ultimately, the negotiations broke down when booking agents and record executives learned more about his relationship with the black Muslims. Malcolm X, one New York columnist learned, has cost him a fortune in endorsements, TV shots, and disc sales. Number one, it just reminded me, with all the current hubbub around Nate Parker and the Birth of a Nation, whites are not ignorant about racism, black people. These whites at this time, 50 years ago, they did their diligence to know about Muhammad Ali, what he was doing, who he was involved with, the Louisville sponsoring group. They were not ignorant. These other people that are trying to get him to cut some records, be on a TV show, they were not ignorant either. So just something to keep in mind. I also thought, just with this paragraph, as though Muhammad Cassius Clay, I guess this is the transition, so having some difficulty picking which, until we get definitively on the Muhammad Ali side. Him being uncertain about how to express himself, just in what I have seen, what I've read, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, does not strike me as someone who was lacking in confidence in terms of not being sure about himself or what he wanted to say. That just does not, I just do not get that impression of Cassius Clay at any point in his life, certainly not Muhammad Ali. I do not claim to be the most knowledgeable person on his life and times, but from what we've read of this text, other material that I've read on him, seen on him, I am not left with that impression. Let's see. Next. It's kind of back to the same major theme, at least it seems to me, of Minister Malcolm scheming, strategizing to manipulate Cassius Clay for his own gains, where they write later in the same chapter, reporters wondered if Malcolm had scripted the entire week in an effort to strengthen his bond with the champ. Malcolm's critics suggested that he was just using Clay. The champ, a writer from sport, maintained had become nothing more than, and this is in quotes, a tool in Malcolm X's feud with the Muslims. This is quoted. It is in footnoted. It's from Prize Fighting Cassius X, which is in Time Magazine. It's available online, or I guess if you have access, if you want to go to the library and check it out, you can read what's in this report. I did think that that was noteworthy, at least, that they had other people at that time. I'm not sure if this is a white writer or not who wrote this piece for Time Magazine, but I thought that was at least significant that there were others of this same time period who took the same unflattering position that Minister Malcolm was just some sort of scheming, conniving individual just trying to use Cassius Clay for whatever he could get, if that would save his life or if that could get him back in good with Elijah Muhammad or what have you. But they did at least include another contemporary source from that time period who took the same position. Let's see, moving forward. This reminded me, I think, last week when Cassius Clay defeats Sonny Liston. He wins the championship. I think some of our listeners questioned. There was a portion in the reading where the white co-authors, where they said that Muhammad Ali winning the championship, that would give him access to greater amount of power to talk about racism, to do things, because he's in this position as heavyweight champion. And some people questioned whether or not that was accurate. Could have just been an act of racism, trying to suggest that black people, particularly black athletes or entertainers, that they have some sort of quote-unquote power as a result of being in these positions, because they have a little bit, few more nickels or what have you that whites have allowed them to have. I kind of juxtapose that with the passage that they had this week, where they're talking about Simeon Adebo. This is an ambassador from Nigeria. Adebo thanked Cassius for befriending Nigerian boxer Dick Tiger and invited him to visit his country. Adebo also encouraged him to accept the responsibilities that came with being champion, a champion recognized by black people all over the world. You are not now what you were before the fight, he said. As the champion of the world, Adebo advised he possessed cultural power, the kind of power that could unify black people in the name of world brotherhood. I thought that was interesting. Do we think Mr. Adebo, do we think that he is not accurately understanding power within the global context of white supremacy? That is a question I'm tossing out if people want to respond to that. A few more things, and then we'll check in to see what folks have to say also about Karma's thoughts about her emotions being manipulated. Also on... Let's see, where they're talking about they're going and they're meeting all of these different world ambassadors and black people from the continent, different parts of the world. It says, yet on or around the day of their second visit to the UN, Malcolm told Cassius and Rudy that Elijah Muhammad was a false prophet who had lied and abused his power. He probably also revealed that Muhammad had impregnated numerous secretaries. When Rudy heard Malcolm talk such blasphemy, he wrestled him to the floor until Cassius pulled them apart. Malcolm's allegations made Cassius question his friend's motives. It made him wonder why Malcolm was staying so close to him all the time. Now, none of that is in quotations except the very last sentence about him, Cassius Clay, wondering why Minister Malcolm was staying with him so much. I thought that that was fascinating and revealed a lot. And that's why I say with this book, really any book, but particularly a book written by a suspected racist, this reference I'll just read the whole footnote, Man of Destiny. This is a couple different authors. So this is one book, Man of Destiny. You can go and read that. And then Abdul Rahman Muhammad, Sam Saxon, did an interview with the authors. So I guess you'd have to check them to get the notes about what was revealed. And then the final reference for this paragraph and this sentence comes from the FBI file, which I've stated all along, in my view, that should be front and center with regards to this book. With everything that we've heard, we haven't got there yet, but the assassination of Malcolm X, any dysfunction within the Nation of Islam, what's happening, conflicts between different black people, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, any disputes, feuds, arguments, problems that are happening, whites are most to blame. And specifically within this text, the surveillance apparatus with the FBI, the COINTELPRO program, that is massive, because there have been so many important moments in this book where the reference is from FBI files, meaning that you had an informant or electronic surveillance, something where racist activity is right in the middle of all of these things that are taking place. I feel like that should really be front and center, and not us getting lost or bogged down on, you know, those no good NOI members, and they're just trifling, you know, ruffians and thugs, and did what they did, not saying that they are perfect, or any black person in terms of how they responded to racism, white supremacy, but the pressure that is being applied that you don't even know about by racist man, racist woman. I thought that was hugely important. Let's see. Really important paragraph here where they're talking about Cassius Clay making the decision that he's going to side with Elijah Muhammad and not with Minister Malcolm. Where he says, I'll try to get the whole paragraph here. Ultimately, Clay submitted to Elijah. When he denounced his slave name and accepted the name Muhammad Ali, he symbolically broke with a heritage tied to bondage. It signified an awakening, a reclaiming, a reclamation of freedom from the white world. But it also cut his ties with Malcolm. Instinctively, more than intellectually, he understood the choice he had to make. And as he had so often before, he chose the less dangerous path. I thought the last sentence in particular, last two sentences, really stuck out to me. And in my view, acts of racism, just consistently, black people are ignorant, whether it's the bell curve, somehow, some way. Black people, intellectually, we are defective. Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, he could not have sat down and come to a logical conclusion. It was just his Negro instinct that led him almost to do the cowardly thing, to not, you know, stand up and, you know, stick by my man, my friend, my blood brother. I'm just, you know, going to be a coward and not think about this and go with Elijah Muhammad, because that is the path of least resistance. I'm not a confrontational person, even though he put his career and life on the line a few short years later because he didn't want to go to the Vietnam War and made that very clear. But he was so much of a coward in this instance that he just took the easier route and went with Elijah Muhammad. That is, and there's no footnotes, no quotes, no nothing. This is Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith. This is all them. Next, where, and they, like I said, they just continue with this theme of Minister Malcolm being really manipulative and how he was using Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. They write just a couple sentences below what I just read. They write, when Malcolm lost the contest for Clay's loyalty, he had no more moves, no more pawns to sacrifice. At that moment, Malcolm was expendable. At that moment, his life was in jeopardy. Just number one, referencing Cassius Clay as a pawn, continuing this kind of diminutive language for how Malcolm X allegedly thought of Cassius Clay in his weaker moments, put that in quotes. And then the last sentence, at that moment, his life was in jeopardy. Minister Malcolm, and really any other black person, their life is in jeopardy as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Well before this moment, they were under FBI surveillance. Even when they were going to the airport to get his family, Betty Shabazz, and his children at the airport, that was referenced earlier on in the book. Sonny Liston obviously was not involved in any of this, and he couldn't even drive out, go out of his driveway without the police coming to harass him and everything that he faced. So, I mean, that's just, it's total nonsense for particularly some white authors to even make a statement of that nature. Minister Malcolm, anybody else, people listening to this phone conversation, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, if you are a black person in particular, non-white person worldwide, your life is in jeopardy. Let's see, a few other things, and then we'll check in with callers. Thomas already pointed that out about the Cassius Clay allegedly wanting older men in his life, needing a father figure, even though it seems that he and his father had a relationship and his father was a part of his life throughout. Let's see. I did think it was significant them pointing out how many victims of racism, many black people, whites were able to put a microphone in front of them or put them on camera to denounce Cassius Clay once he changed his name to Muhammad Ali, to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's doing this, and he's not an American, he's not for civil rights. I mean, they had an all-star list, Jackie Robinson and Floyd Patterson and Dr. Martin Luther King, all-star list. People, some of that was even in the letter to Muhammad Ali by Shelby Sancor, which is a really great piece. You can download it if you want to check it out. This is Black Journalists. It's a whole magazine. They have an article interview with Malcolm X later on in the same article. It's really interesting if you want to check it out. One of the portions that they read, this is referenced in Blood Brothers, but the portion, let's see if I can pick it out really quick. Let's see. Before the World Boxing Association announced its intentions, you had already been denounced by such black nobles as Martin Luther King, A.S. Doc Young, and Jackie Robinson, as Paul Robeson, who was never proven a communist, and other living martyrs can testify, black condemnation frequently antecedes white strangulation. I'm thinking of Nate Parker again for some strange reason. Continuing, Robeson stated a few years back, the State Department couldn't have imprisoned him if Negro leaders had spoken out or simply remained neutral. In fact, said Robeson, they did what they did only with active cooperation of some top Negro leadership, including the late Walter White and Jackie Robinson, who was just spitting out words Lester Granger had put in his mouth. That's all in quotes. It's unfortunately baffling that so many well-educated Negroes are unable to appreciate black people who make powerful whites uncomfortable. All of that is Shelby Sancor, letter to Muhammad Ali. I think that is still in effect, and I think under the system of white supremacy, racists are easily able to manipulate any victims of racism as long as they have more power. This is the product of terrorism, where anytime whites are not happy, whites are quote-unquote uncomfortable, it is very, very easy to grab anybody on the plantation to get them to say whatever you want, do whatever you want, to reprimand, deal with whatever Negro is the subject of that white person's ire, or if it's a group of white people who are upset. Let's see, what else did I have? Final couple things that stood out, and then we'll check in with folks. I thought this whole paragraph reminded me of Donald Trump when they said, at a time when minorities held half the major division boxing titles, it appeared that black and brown men dominated the entire sport. The days when boxing made white men rich and black men cripples, that's all in quotes, were long gone. That just, in my view, cannot be true at all. Whether we're talking 1964 or 2016, that is simply not true. Not the black people dominating part, but the days where white men were rich and black men cripples, that is in effect like right now and has been for the duration of racism, white supremacy. I would challenge anybody to show me that that ain't so. Continuing with this paragraph, it reads, white writers and white fans lamented the loss of an era. Whites, they said, never got a shot at the heavyweight title anymore. It seemed that the black man had taken over everything, the cities, the streets, the old neighborhoods, even sports. More blacks could be seen on television playing baseball, basketball, and football, and now the black man had taken over boxing too. Now that the equal opportunity movement has brought such an improvement to the lot of the Negro, Dan Parker asked, when are the white heavyweights going to start picketing the weighing in scales at boxing commission offices for the same deal? That is the same type of absurdity that you hear now, as though Negroes have taken over and whites are losing out, as though the system of white supremacy is not still in effect. Astounding on many levels. Even reminds me of Dr. Welsing to some point, because I've been rereading the ISIS papers. And then them moving to get rid of boxing, which was the exact same thing they did in the earlier 20th century with Jack Johnson when he won the heavyweight championship. Negroes got the title. Oh, my God, we need to get rid of the sports. This this is a disgrace. I would even compare it to what happened with the dress code in the NBA when you had LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, lots of very, very young black athletes coming directly out of high school and dominating, getting all kinds of big contracts. And it's, this is a disgrace. The NBA sucks, and we need to do away with this. No more high schoolers going directly to the NBA. Standard operating procedure for whites. Last thing, I'm not sure if we're going to get there or not. I might be jumping ahead. Floyd Patterson was also one of the ones, former heavyweight champion, who challenged Muhammad Ali and said, you know, he wasn't an American and I want to fight him and what have you. Floyd Patterson eventually did stand up for Muhammad Ali. He wrote an incredible article. I published it on my social media sites earlier this year, closer to when Muhammad Ali transitioned, where, in my view, it is an amazing illustration of black self-respect, what Floyd Patterson later did. I don't know if they're going to bring that up in the text, but that is down the road. I think I will stop there. Last portion I'll get in. This was right before the end of the first audio segment. This is after Minister Malcolm has broken away from the Nation of Islam. He gives his press conference, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and what his plans are going to be post-Nation of Islam career. When he's talking about 1964, it's going to be a really violent year, which it was. And he says, because 1964 threatens to be a very explosive year on the racial front, that's Minister Malcolm. So then they pause and they insert the authors. In fact, it would be one of the most violent in American history. Just in my view, that sort of sentence is absurd in a system of white supremacy. What do you mean? One of the most violent years in American history. You have perpetual terrorism against black people worldwide. Now, if you just want to talk about this area of the world, when you're talking about a hemisphere where you had centuries of enslavement that mandated daily whippings, rapings, abuse, again, reference, the half has never been told, that's every day. Where you have a whole civil war conflict where more than a half million people are killed over a 5-year period. What are you talking about? Where that's followed by decades of lynching, killing, castrating blacks with impunity, where half of that, we don't even have the actual tolls on the number of black people who died and all of that. Black Wall Street, Rosewood, Slocum, Texas, more of these than you could even add up. Wilmington, North Carolina, the list just goes on and on and on. What are you talking about? This is one of the most violent years in American history. This is perpetual, everyday activity. This is just another routine day, another routine year in the system of white supremacy that mandates black death in huge numbers constantly. What are you even talking about? I will pause there. Did folks either want to respond to Karma's question about her emotions being manipulated with how we're thinking about the Nation of Islam? I think I also posed the question about was the ambassador from the continent, was he in error in talking about Muhammad Ali being in a position of what he framed as cultural power, or any other observations that stood out?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to say first, in regards to the question about the Mr. Sankore, who made that statement, because the statement was made in the context of unifying black people potentially globally, I would say it was accurate. And the reason why is because when he did reach the pinnacle of his popularity, especially I would say during the fight that he had in Zimbabwe, essentially that's exactly what he was doing. He was making connections between himself as a black male from the United States and the black people in Africa. So I think in that context that he was correct, that there was a certain kind of power he could have wielded to be a cohesive, like the ability to bring people from different parts of the world who looked like us, who may have thought on some level they were separate from us in some way, but were experiencing white racism, white supremacy where they were. And because of his ability to be so outspoken about racism, white supremacy, wherever he went, I think those two things are what would have been able to help him potentially facilitate some sort of connection between black people in the States and black people in other parts of the world. I would also look at too, I would also look at what Malcolm did himself, Minister Malcolm X, when he started to gather world leaders, not just from Africa, but from the Caribbean and from Asia, the Far East as well. And he was able to get those world leaders from these different countries together. And he was preparing to take the United States government to court, as well as all of the European powers that participated in the slave trade and all other kinds of brutality against non-white people, to international court on human rights abuses. So I think when you look at that in its proper context, that is something I think was accurate as far as him making that statement, in my opinion. I could be wrong, but I would say that's something I think it was a definite potentiality that he had as he became more popular as a boxer and basically a world elder statesman as he traveled and spoke to different people. Now, the question that Karma posed, I thought was brilliant because I think it is highly accurate. I think beyond the emotional roller coaster, I would say the key phrase is to basically what it is that via suggestive language, they are trying to facilitate postmortem anti-blackness. So in other words, they're saying things that in some cases are partially quoted or quoted, but a good healthy portion of it is not quoted. It's just them adding their tidbits or their thoughts and ideas. And these ideas are either anti-Muhammad Ali in some way, saying that he's deceptive, or anti-Malcolm X in some way, and of course saying he's deceptive. But the last part that you read, excuse me, the last section that you read just before you took statements, to me, it feels like it's almost like the boxing's version of affirmative action, essentially, boxing's version of White Lives Matter, as far as they're making a statement about white boxers making some sort of complaint to the Boxing Commission in regards to white heavyweight fighters. It seems like the boxing's version of like affirmative action for white boxers or something like that. And I just feel like a lot of the language is just really suggestive, and it's geared towards creating a feeling in the readers, especially if they're black. It's either like Karma was saying, you're taking Malcolm's side and just despising the NOI. Then you're taking Muhammad Ali is being portrayed as being deceptive in all kinds of ways, as is Malcolm X in his own way. And then they're also adding the information that is basically stating that Malcolm X was basically using him to prolong his life in some way or something of that nature. And in my opinion, Malcolm's life was in danger the moment, as far as from the NOI, from the moment that Elijah made the decision that he would no longer reinstate him. So at that point, I think the wheels were turning in regards to potentially harming Malcolm in some way. And as Malcolm started to speak out, that started to ratchet up. And then when you add the fact that the FBI was also fostering issues between them because they had agents in the NOI at that time, and then also you had, and I wonder what time frame the FBI visit to Malcolm X took place too, because these are all things that have to be taken into account. You know, the FBI sent two agents in person to basically try and get him to, you know, give them information on Elijah Muhammad, and he didn't do so. He basically told him to kick rocks. And there's so much going on, and I feel that the authors are definitely manipulating the psyches, especially of black people who read this book, to just foster anti-blackness on as many levels as possible. And in a lot of ways, the authors themselves are being deceptive because a lot of the information is really hearsay that they're inserting. Like you had read a couple of things earlier where they were just inserting things, and these things were inflammatory. And the funny part is Manning Marable's book had the same sort of rhetoric that caused these other black authors to write a book in rebuttal to the things they disagreed with that he wrote about Malcolm X as well. So this is just a very interesting thing, and I'd love to hear what the other callers have to say. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
The caller at 4231, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, peace to the callers, to the host, and to the platform. What I would like to add, like what stood out the most to me or what keeps standing out the most to me in the current times and in this book is, you know, we live in a world now where allegedly, you know, if you're a non-Muslim, even though they put most of the theology on black Muslims, and kind of separating that theology from Islam is practiced by the Arabs that they kind of said in the book. And we live in a world like where, you know, if you're non-Muslim or something, like you're basically probably under some terrorism or, you know, there's this big threat. But then, you know, taking the honest look at racism and white supremacy, and it's even more worse, I would say, if you're a non-white and under the same type of conditions. And, you know, the way that they use Christianity in the racism and white supremacy as far as being able to idolize a white Jesus figure to you and things like that, I definitely see why they have a deep hatred for even what the things the black Muslims were saying that may be contrary to popular belief or whatever, but even the tenets of the Islam religion as itself, you know, there's really no room for racism, white supremacy to exist in that area of people activity under that particular dynamic, so to say, the religion of Islam. And so I just see that as being connected back then and even now today with all of this jihadi talk. But, you know, I live blocks away from a school that's named after the Crusaders. So, I mean, it's very ironic, but logically I do put these things together. And I think that when Malcolm realized that it was the difference between what he was being told and what really was, and the fact that the Elijah Muhammad, even though he was a imam at best, or a sheep or something like that, he tried to be the prophet that revealed the book, which, you know, was something totally different in itself. So that's all I wanted to add, and appreciate everyone for listening.
For sure. We have about 6 minutes left before we get to the second audio segment. Other folks want to share? If you had thoughts, either response to Karma's question or anything else that's been shared?
Yeah, I'd like to say, first I want to say, I think Roz used the term post-mortem anti-blackness. That's pretty interesting. I totally agree with what Karma said, because it just made perfect logical sense. I find that they villainize Elijah Muhammad anytime they write about him. You know, it's just gotten to the point where they're starting to heroicize Malcolm X, because when I was young, he was not given the same treatment he's given today. They tried to pin him up against Martin Luther King all the way. You know, he was the good one, that was the bad one. That was pretty much how it went. And I find that they're using the platform of literature to rewrite history, which is what white people always do, history revisionism. So all these quotes, even some of these people that books they're quoting, this you would have to go back to that book to see who those people are quoting, because that could have been those persons' own words that they're using to redefine this whole movement. I don't agree with a lot of what either side did, but the way that they write about it in comparison to when black people write about it is totally different. It's not villainizing one side over the other normally. It's usually giving both sides the just point of view. And another part of the reading that stood out, and I just thought of it when the last caller spoke, was the way they spoke so bad about the Arab people in the Middle East. And, you know, it was sort of like a slick way, sheeps, and the way they described them. And I'm sitting here thinking, that's how you guys back your money, is with their oil. Like, they'll take your resources and just don't care. I'm getting my line thinking.
Right on. I wanted to just ask really quick. This is, let's see, we can do a... We'll do it this way. Only say anything if you've read it, and I just need a yes. If you haven't read it, just don't say anything, so that way it'll be silence if people haven't read it. Has anyone read Carl Evans' The Judas Factor? That is a book that's been referenced regularly here. Has anyone read Carl Evans' The Judas Factor? Just a yes will suffice.
Yes.
Got one? Anybody else? Carl Evans' The Judas Factor? All right. That is a great book. I would encourage folks to read. It will give you a very different perspective on this book and what happened with Minister Malcolm's break from the Nation of Islam, Cassius Clay, all of that, written by a black author. And I think he's still alive. I'd be curious if he has read this, because this book is cited regularly. Did you get the impression reading that book, if you recall, I don't know, you know, how long it's been since you read it, but did you get the impression reading that book that one could walk away from that book thinking of the Nation of Islam as kind of a gangster organization? I think that was the term used earlier. Could you get that impression reading Carl Evans' book?
Carl Evans' book was so well researched. Like you said, it's one of my favorite books. I read it more than once, but I read it a while ago, and now you're making me want to pull it right back off the shelf, which I think I'm going to do. But from what I remember, because of the types of things that Elijah Muhammad was authorizing, you would get that impression. But I think it was really like a balance, and that's why I love the fact that you always discuss us not judging black people, because whatever we do is always a reaction to white supremacy, and how we react can be a myriad of ways. Because if you look at the organization itself and what it did for black people in its heyday and in its prime, it was phenomenal. And nothing like that ever existed before or since when it was done. But then you have to look at the people that he was saving, the people he was helping, were people who ran the streets. These were people who, you know, were hustlers. Some of them were killers. So these were people who came from the same background as Malcolm. And it's essentially, I truly believe that a person, a human being, always goes back when they're put in a situation where they're under high duress. You go back to what you know. It becomes almost an instinctive thing. And Malcolm actually Malcolm knew these people because he trained them, and he knew their street pedigree before they came into the Nation. So essentially, at one point, when he started to separate what was happening to him, he started to separate NOI tactics from FBI tactics, because he started to realize things were a lot deeper than he was perceiving, and that's when his language started to shift. And what you got to give Minister Malcolm credit for is for all of the things that were going on, and for all of the hurt and in some cases anger he had at some of the things Elijah Muhammad did, he never broke and went to the FBI and told anything about him, or did anything to directly impact that organization in a negative fashion. All he wanted was the truth to come out. So I give him credit for that. But ultimately, yes, I think you can get that impression, but I think it's presented in a way where I think it's holistic. Carl Evans' book is way more holistic, and the writing is not anti-black. I feel that these authors, like I think Thomas was so accurate when he said they're trying to change history, literally change history itself. Where our perceptions of Muhammad Ali will be tainted. Our perceptions of Malcolm X will be tainted. Our perception of the entire nation, not just Elijah Muhammad, would be tainted. And unless you either knew people who were in the nation or you yourself might have been in the nation, you would understand things were not the way it's being presented by these white authors. And that is the horrific situation that happens when your enemy is telling your story. And, you know, even with what I was going to say, even with what you said earlier, in regards to the authors talking about it being one of the most violent years in the history of the country, and that's deception. That's what they're doing. They're changing history. They're being deceptive, but in the most white supremacist way possible, because they know as white people they're going to be viewed as authority figures on whatever they speak about. Even though we know that white people are the greatest liars that have ever touched down on the planet Earth, the idea is that because they're in control and because of the power they wield, they're automatically believed in a way that a black person wouldn't be. So I think that Carl Evans presented this, just to go back to circle back. I think he did a more balanced gave a more balanced perspective. But just based on the tactics, you would get that impression, but not necessarily in a way that would impact how you viewed the nation as a whole. In other words, he gave you the good and he gave you the negative that came with it, but in a more holistic manner and in a non-anti-black manner. And that's the major difference between Carl. And his book is extremely well-researched. Like, his footnote game is no joke. His revealing of classified documents, I mean, he gives it all to you. So, I mean, ultimately, it's just a 2,000% better book, and I would suggest any and everybody get their hands on it and read it because it'll definitely shift your consciousness. He touches on...
Hang on. I want to make sure we...
No apologies.
Make sure we get to our second audio segment. I did just want to include one more tidbit from Shelby St. Cor, because this is a black writer as well, to make sure we're including some black researchers, black writers who have contributed a lot. And a lot of these folks are quoted within this book as well. So I read a little bit before. This is a letter to Muhammad Ali. So this is the last part I'll get in before we get to the second audio segment where he writes, A.S. Doc Young wrote in the Los Angeles Sentinel, which is a black publication, sober thinking hardly supports the merging of the black Muslim cult and boxing any more than it supports the merging of the nudist cult and boxing or the White Citizens Council and boxing. In these times, is it inconceivable that an acknowledged White Citizens Council member could win the championship? In parentheses, how does he know? He also found it disturbing that you refused an interracial celebration in Miami Beach and spent most of your time in the Negro section of Miami before moving on for a repeat in Harlem's Teresa Hotel. You are urged by Reverend King, quoting from the White Press, to spend more time improving boxing skills and do less talking, in quotes. He also crowned you a champion of racial segregation, in quotes. He feels boxing has declined so terribly since the days of Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano, in quotes. Jackie Robinson feels you are to be pitied. LA Sentinel, March 5th, 1964. He was surprised at you. Forgive them, Cassius. They know not what they are doing. Shelby St. Cor, great article. You can read the whole thing. This is from The Liberator, May 1964. With that, we will get to the second audio segment. Folks have other commentary they would like to share, just to make a note, and we should have ample time. So we're picking up. We're in Chapter 14, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Cassius Clay, audio segment number 2.
Elijah's precious treasure finally arrived at his home. On Saturday, March 14th, a day after Muhammad Ali took another Army entrance exam in Louisville, the champ visited Elijah in Chicago. Before he drove to Elijah's mansion, a crowd of reporters met Ali at the airport, pestering him with questions about his relationship with Malcolm. "Muhammad taught Malcolm X everything he knows," he said. "So I couldn't go with the child. I go with the daddy." At the mansion, Ali and his brother embraced Elijah. Sitting on the living room couch with his arm around Elijah, Ali listened as the soft-spoken elder read from the Quran, lecturing about Allah. They discussed his victory over Liston, the backlash against his Muslim name, and his plans to travel abroad. Elijah told him that many Americans hated the idea of a Muslim champion because there was widespread hatred of the Muslims and Islam in America. That is why boxing officials wanted to vacate his title and why so many people refused to use his Muslim name. Ali left that night, convinced of Elijah's wisdom and power. "Can't nobody prove Elijah Muhammad wrong," he declared. During Ali's visit in Chicago, Elijah entrusted his third son to supervise Ali and manage his financial affairs. Herbert Muhammad spent most of his time in Chicago running various Muslim enterprises, chauffeuring his father, and editing Muhammad Speaks. A short, pudgy photographer with his own studio and limited formal education, Herbert knew very little about managing a boxer. When he was a boy, his father saw him punching a speed bag in the family garage and scolded him for wasting his time. "I don't want you around the ring, boxing for any little fat white man with a big cigar," he lectured. "Don't be around any sport world. Sport is the ruin of our people. Turns them into children who are used and then left broken. Stay out of it." By the time the heavyweight champion sat in his living room, though, Elijah had changed his mind about Herbert's involvement in boxing. He reminded his son that crooks ran the sport. Con men, he warned, would try to dupe Ali. Make sure nobody robs him or takes advantage of him. Elijah told Ali that he could trust his son and that Herbert would treat him like a brother. In time, Herbert would become Ali's financial advisor, mentor, and confidant. Most importantly, he served as Elijah's eyes and ears, following Ali everywhere. That weekend, when Ali first met Herbert at his studio, the fighter did not know much about him, except what Elijah had told him. Herbert had photographed many famous black men, including Kwame Nkrumah, Prince Faisal, Gamal Abdel Nasser, and other statesmen whom he promised Ali would meet when they visited the Middle East and Africa. But when Herbert began traveling with Ali, he refused interviews and photographs. He did not want to do anything that would raise questions about his personal life. The last time his name made headlines was in October 1962, when a white woman pressed charges against him for shattering her jaw in four places. Herbert's former mistress told police that he stalked her, broke into her apartment, and threatened to kill her if she ever left him. The Muslims adamantly denied the charges, claiming that the woman was not even white, she was black, and that Herbert was being framed, all in an attempt to smear and malign the Nation of Islam. Although the story disappeared from the front page of the Chicago Defender, it caught the attention of the FBI. When special agents began investigating Herbert, an informant told them that he carried on extramarital affairs and was nearly possessed with taking nude photographs of women and making pornographic films. According to a reliable source, Herbert convinced women to pose for his camera in exchange for gifts of jewelry and mink coats. Of course, Ali did not know about any of this. He had only just met Herbert, after all, and Elijah had said that he could trust his son. Ali never questioned the messenger. He simply did what he was told. Muhammad Ali's life had become a daily news story, unfolding across the pages of America's newspapers. Since he took his first military entrance exam, writers had speculated that he would be drafted any day, ending America's nightmare of having a Muslim boxing champion. On March 20th, the Army announced that Ali had failed his second entrance exam, disqualifying him from serving in the armed forces. One report claimed that he scored 78 on an IQ test, placing him well below a passing grade. Embarrassed by his poor performance, Ali admitted that he struggled to comprehend the questions. "I said I was the greatest, not the smartest," he quipped. After returning to New York, he fielded questions from reporters at an impromptu press conference from the Hotel Teresa. Writers' repeated queries about his intellect angered him. When a reporter addressed him as Cassius, he snapped. "Don't call me Cassius Clay. My name is Muhammad Ali. It is a beautiful Arabic name." It was the first time that he insisted writers use his new name. When another reporter made the same mistake, he corrected him. "Don't call me Cassius Clay anymore. I am Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight champion of the whole world." Later that night, he attended a welterweight match between Luis Rodriguez and Holly Mims at Madison Square Garden. Expecting a champion's introduction, Ali was stunned when promoter Harry Markson refused to let the ring announcer use his Muslim name. Standing near the aisle, about 20 rows away from the ring, Ali declared, "Cassius Clay is a slave name. My real name now, from now on, is Muhammad Ali. I'll be introduced as Muhammad Ali, or there'll be no introduction." Fans booed the champ until he bolted out of the arena. Many Americans were just as outraged that the Army had rejected Ali as he was that they refused to use his Muslim name. Furious citizens, soldiers, and veterans grumbled that Ali was certainly smart enough to peel potatoes, scrub a ship deck, or polish boots. A real American, they complained, would certainly find a way to serve. In Philadelphia, a concerned Irish Catholic mother, whose son had been recently drafted, resented the special treatment Ali seemed to receive from the military. she could hardly believe that Ali failed the military's entrance requirements. In a letter to President Lyndon Johnson, she asked why the Army did not draft the famous boxer. Is it because he is a millionaire and pays lots of taxes? Is it because he is heavyweight champion of the world? Is it because he is colored, and colored people are being handled with kid gloves these days? Those who knew Ali well were not really surprised that he had flunked the military exam. Petros Spanakos, a bantamweight teammate of Ali's during the 1960 Olympics, wrote to columnist Red Smith, explaining that he had no doubt that his old roommate could not pass the written exam. When they roomed together in Rome, Spanakos spelled out, corrected, and finally wrote Ali's letters home. Louisville sponsoring group member William Faversham told a writer that he had also witnessed Ali struggle to read. While he could read a newspaper column in 3 or 4 minutes, it could take Ali more than 20. Faversham recalled that in January 1963, shortly after Ali fought Charlie Powell, he suggested that Ali should schedule a match against Doug Jones in March. Uncertain if he had enough time to train, Ali asked, "How many months until March?" From every angle, Americans scrutinized Ali's intelligence. J. Edgar Hoover was so convinced that Ali had deliberately failed the test that he ordered special agents to obtain the champ's high school transcript, which only proved that Ali lacked a rigorous academic education. Critics emasculated him as simple-minded and childlike. Others reduced him to the big dumb boxer, as ignorant as Amos Jones's friend Andy Brown, a bombastic and buffoonish black man. A few days after the Army disqualified Ali, Robert Lipsight ventured into Harlem to interview the champ. But first, he dropped by Louis Michaud's bookstore, where he interviewed Malcolm X. Accompanied by the reporter's friend, comedian and activist Dick Gregory, Lipsight found Malcolm lounging in a back room, rapping with Michaud. Malcolm spoke warmly about Ali, less like his guru than an older brother or uncle. Divulging no hard feelings, he had nothing but nice things to say about him. When the writer asked Malcolm if he had tried to persuade the champ to join MMI, Malcolm shook his head and explained that Ali would have to decide for himself how he would live his life. As Lipsight turned toward the door, Malcolm praised his fight coverage as among the best. Lipsight smiled and thanked him. Later, when he recounted the story to an editor at the New York Times, he received a flippant reply. "That's just great. We'll put it up on the newspaper trucks. Malcolm X loves Lipsight." After departing Michaud's bookstore, Lipsight and Gregory crossed the street to the Hotel Teresa, where the champion was staying in a suite just a few floors above Malcolm's second-story office. In the most popular accounts, Ali immediately cut Malcolm out of his life and stopped seeing him after March 6th. But that would be hard to believe, since Ali was staying in the same building where Malcolm worked. The reality was that neither man had let go of the other. After Ali returned to Harlem in late March, a reporter from the New York Post interviewed Malcolm and noted that a parade of visitors entered his office, including Ali, who dropped by for a swift, low-voiced chat. Ali may have been a follower of the lost-found Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, the writer observed, but schism has not damaged an old friendship with Malcolm X. While Elijah's lieutenants scorned his friend as a hypocrite, Ali had not yet rejected Malcolm's friendship, despite telling Elijah what he wanted to hear. Unquestionably, after Ali visited Elijah in Chicago and returned to Harlem, he and Malcolm saw each other. Most likely, they met on March 22nd, the same day that Malcolm held a rally at the Rockland Palace. Earlier, Malcolm had acknowledged to a television reporter that he had a long meeting with Ali, but he refused to discuss the details of their conversation. "We are brothers," he told the newswoman, "and we have much in common." What he did not tell her was that they could no longer be seen together in public. Instead, Malcolm implied that he still advised Ali. However, a few hours after the WBA announced its intention to vacate Ali's title, Malcolm clearly had heard nothing about it. He no longer knew what Ali was really doing. When the reporter asked how he would counsel the champ about his career, Malcolm found himself speechless. All he could say about the matter was, no comment. Instead, Malcolm talked about Ali's potential as a cultural force, a global hero, inspiring people around the world. Americans misunderstood the boxer, he explained. The champion was an ideal role model for black youths, living a clean life, avoiding alcohol and cigarettes. And, Malcolm reminded the reporter, Ali had never been involved in any legal trouble. He's actually an all-American boy, or an all-African boy. The problem, he charged, was that the media distorted his image and attacked his religion, damaging America's reputation abroad. Malcolm had received stacks of letters from Africans who admired Ali and everything he represented. Cassius is in a better position than anyone else to restore a sense of racial pride not only to our people in this country, but to people all over the world. Malcolm's conversation with Ali made it difficult for the boxer to completely divorce his friend. While Ali hated the idea of disappointing Elijah Muhammad, he also wanted to avoid hurting Malcolm. In his private moments, he must have wondered if he had made the right decision. When a writer from Jet asked him if he would ever see Malcolm again, he answered, "Elijah Muhammad will determine my future associations." Then, in a wistful moment of sincerity, he disclosed his true sentiments. "Malcolm," he said, "is still a friend, however." It was not the kind of comment that would please the messenger. In the weeks after he announced his independence from Elijah, Malcolm spoke at rallies, met with reporters, and began planning a trip to the Middle East and Africa. The excursion would serve two needs, one personal, the other political. When he broke from the Nation of Islam, his religious foundation cracked. As a servant of Allah, he sought a renewed faith and a broader understanding of Islam. In a quest to fulfill his religious evolution, he prepared for the pilgrimage to Mecca, the holiest Muslim city in the world. The journey to the Middle East would also help him realize his vision for internationalizing the black freedom struggle. In Cleveland, on April 3rd, he preached the gospel of black nationalism, arguing that blacks needed to control their own communities, their own politics, and their own religion. At the Cory Methodist Church, Malcolm espoused a message fusing together electoral politics, self-defense, and Pan-Africanism, framing the civil rights movement as part of a global struggle against racial oppression. "We need to expand the civil rights struggle to a higher level, to the level of human rights," he suggested. Focusing on civil rights made blacks too dependent on the United States government, a government that had failed to protect their legal rights. "Human rights differed from civil rights," he explained. "Human rights were your God-given rights, recognized by the United Nations. And any time anyone violates your human rights, you can take them to the World Court," he promised. At the UN, our brothers from Africa, Asia, and Latin America would finally hear the charges against the U.S. "Uncle Sam's hands are dripping with the blood of the black man in this country." If Uncle Sam would not defend black citizens, then they needed to defend themselves by any means necessary. "If we don't do something soon, I think you'll have to agree that we're going to be forced either to use the ballot or the bullet," he argued. If Uncle Sam denied them the vote, they must rise up in arms. "It'll be liberty or death." Malcolm spoke that night, not as an American, but as a black man. "No, I'm not an American," he declared. "I'm one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are the victims of democracy, nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So, I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American, or a patriot, or a flag saluter, or a flag waver. No, not I. I'm speaking as a victim of the American system. And I see America through the eyes of the victim." Bristling, he concluded, "I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare. Malcolm's rhetoric altered the way many blacks viewed themselves and their country. In The Ballot or the Bullet, he spoke about what it meant to be an American. He reminded them, being born here in America doesn't make you an American. How could a black man call himself an American as long as he was denied basic freedoms? If black men and women were Americans, then they would not need civil rights legislation. You and I, he declared, are African Americans. That's what we are. Africans born in America. Muhammad Ali also began to see himself as an African born in America, interpreting his title in global terms. After meeting with African ambassadors who praised him as an international hero, he began to view himself as something more than an American champion. When he changed his name and announced that he was a Muslim, critics vilified him as unpatriotic and un-American. He understood, as Malcolm had said, that being born in America did not make him an American. In his search for self-discovery, he decided to travel to Africa. When he returned, he came back a new man, one who defined himself as a global citizen, declaring, "I'm not an American. I'm a black man." Chapter 15. King of the World. Millions of so-called Negroes in this country have a distorted image of our homeland. They think Africans eat each other and live in mud huts. They've been brainwashed by the white man. Why, I'll show you muddier huts in Harlem than they've got over in Africa. Malcolm X. I heard a voice once that told me one day I would be a world figure. Muhammad Ali. The king! The king! The crowd shouted, swarming the famous American as he sat in an open-top cream-colored convertible. Who's the king? Muhammad Ali called, basking in the adulation and equatorial sunshine of Accra. You! The locals assented, celebrating the arrival of the self-proclaimed king of the world. From the moment Ali set foot on African soil, Ghanaians treated him like royalty, showering him with praise and gifts. At the Accra airport on May 16, 1964, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Director of Sports, the Chairman of Ghana Boxing Authority, and other state officials welcomed him. President Kwame Nkrumah, the first national leader to embrace Ali, directed the government's radio stations and newspapers to promote the American champion as an African hero, a source of inspiration to the youth of the world. In the words of a writer from the state-owned Daily Graphic, if there is one man who can assist positively to bring about Nkrumah's cherished aims of projecting the African personality, an Africa freed from the vestiges of colonialism, and disprove the superiority complex of the white man, he is Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. Ali told reporters that he was anxious to get around and see Africa and meet my own brothers and sisters. Unsure how his words would translate in a foreign land, he spoke cautiously when he explained that white slave traders had captured his ancestors from Africa and sold them into bondage in America. We are glad to be back home to see things for ourselves, meet pretty Ghanaian girls, take pictures, and tell our people that there are more things to be seen in Africa than lions and elephants. As Ali prepared to leave the airport, children shouted his name and waved welcome signs, while policemen brandishing truncheons ordered the crowd to back away from the motorcade. Driving through the paved streets of Accra, Ali marveled at what he saw. Streetlights, honking buses and taxis, apartment buildings, and department stores, hotels, nightclubs, and restaurants where blacks and whites socialized amicably. The city came alive with the sounds of high-life music blaring from storefront windows, laughing children running through the streets, and saleswomen bartering with customers in the Makola market. He was surprised to see that Accra had wide streets, tall buildings, and other modern features. He explained to a local reporter that whites had so distorted the image of Africa that black Americans would not dare visit their homeland. They never told us about your beautiful flowers, magnificent hotels, beautiful houses, beaches, great hospitals, schools, and universities. Like many Americans, Ali had imagined Africa as an exotic land, a vast jungle inhabited by wild animals, noble savages, and great white hunters. Most Americans knew very little about Africa beyond what they saw on screen or read in magazines. In 1953, when Ali was 11 years old, Time published a feature article about the British Gold Coast that described the colony as a rectangular patch of jungle, swamp, and bushland, even though deserts, forests, and rolling savanna grasslands shaped its landscape. The British colony that would eventually become Ghana was nothing more than a sun-baked wasteland filled with primitive people living in holes in the ground. Their women go naked with a tuft of leaves before and behind. According to Time, the happy-go-lucky Gold Coasters crowded their mud huts with radios, sewing machines, bicycles, and even TV sets, though there is no TV station to tune into. Ali grew up in a culture saturated with myths about Africa. In 1960, during the Rome Olympics, he had compared America favorably to Africa, whose natives, he said, were still fighting alligators and living in mud huts. Unlike Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay thought very little about Africa and cared even less. In his view, Africans were not a celebrated people, they were the butt of his jokes. In 1962, he told sports writer Myron Cope a story about an encounter with two African men. "Man," he chuckled, "I was down at the beach with two of them Africans. They so black, they almost blue. But they said to me, 'Cassius, we have to leave now and go put on our turbans and uniforms, 'cause if we don't, people gonna think we're Negroes.'" Yet, when he accepted the name Muhammad Ali, he embraced the idea of being an African born in America. In Accra, he proudly declared, "I am an African, and my proper name is Muhammad Ali. There is greater dignity in my new name than his slave name." In America, he explained, too many blacks disgracefully bear the names of our masters. Echoing Malcolm, he suggested that if Negroes could not find justice in America, then they should migrate back to Africa. His pan-African rhetoric pleased Elijah Muhammad. At a time when Malcolm, civil rights leaders, and the national media were criticizing the Nation of Islam, Elijah determined that Ali's trip abroad would overshadow their attacks, helping him legitimize his Muslim movement. Sending Ali on an international excursion would bring universal recognition to the nation. Before the heavyweight champion left the U.S., he went on a tour of black Muslim mosques, where he signed autographs, sold copies of Muhammad Speaks, and announced his future travels, crediting Elijah for his worldwide fame. "It is because I am a follower of the Messenger that has brought me personal invitations from Asia and African presidents and prime ministers." Elijah predicted that Ali would receive a hero's welcome in Africa and the Middle East, but he reserved profound doubts about the regions. Romanticizing his own journey there in 1959, Elijah embellished the way Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser graciously welcomed him into his palace. While he enjoyed meeting Arab and African statesmen and Muslim clerics, he returned to America disillusioned by the extreme poverty he saw, which he interpreted as a weakness in the people. Before his trip, he had talked about building an emigration movement to Africa, but afterward, he ceased considering the plan. Years after his trek abroad, he complained that Africans still lived a jungle life, deriding them as savages in need of his civilizing influence. Although he praised the emergence of independent African nations, he remained uninterested in building any genuine relationships with African leaders. Malcolm was convinced that Elijah had sent Ali to Africa solely for personal gain. "You cannot read anything that Elijah Muhammad has ever written that's pro-African," he charged. "I defy you to find one word in his direct writings that is pro-African. You can't find it." For Elijah, Ali's journey abroad served as a propaganda mission that he hoped would demonstrate his stature in the Islamic world elevating his standing among black Americans. During his five-week trip, Ali was accompanied by Muslims and friends, including the champ's manager, Herbert Muhammad, his brother, Rudy, who had recently taken the name Rahman Ali, Archie Robinson, who now introduced himself as Osman Kareem, photographer Howard Bingham, and Ronnie King, an old friend. Herbert also hired Charles P. Howard, a United Nations correspondent, to write stories about Ali's journey for Muhammad Speaks. By the time Ali's motorcade reached the government-owned six-story Ambassador Hotel, it seemed as if the entire city was trailing behind it. Countless locals camped outside the hotel, hoping to get a glimpse of him. Not wanting to disappoint them, Ali emerged into view on the terrace, shouting below, "Who's the king?" "You are," the crowd thundered. In Africa, Ali discovered that he was more popular abroad than at home. While most Americans refused to recognize his Muslim name, strangers, writers, and dignitaries in Ghana, Nigeria, and Egypt showed him respect by acknowledging it. Everywhere he went, people cheered his name like he was their champion, a black hero whose name mattered as much as his accomplishments in the ring. "Muhammad Ali is in Africa, all over Africa," he said later. "The name is in Ethiopia, Morocco, Syria, Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey, Algiers, Saudi Arabia. Muhammad Ali was a common name when I traveled. Muhammad is the most common name in the world." Ali's African journey marked a pivotal moment in his life, ushering in a new era when he would become one of the most recognizable and written about people in the world. But he had become something more than famous. His name had global meaning. During an age of rapid global change, decolonization in Africa and Asia, and the emerging political power of the Middle East, Ali became a liminal figure, quite literally a man betwixt and between cultures. More than any other athlete, he put the world into the title of world champion. In Africa, one could sense that Ali's views about himself, his country, and the world had changed. Something happened to him on that trip, something that stuck with Osman Kareem. "I'll remember that trip for as long as I live, because that was where I saw Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali."
That will do it for this week. We have two sessions left. Two sessions left, and we will be all done. Context of white supremacy, Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. If you would like to participate, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last moment. If you have thoughts you would like to share, if you did not speak up during the first discussion after audio segment number 1, you should get your hand up immediately. Do not wait until the last minute if you have thoughts, observations you would like to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. We'll start. I'll try and make sure we get folks who didn't get to share the first time around. Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have commentary you wanted to share, sir?
Greetings.
Greetings, sir.
I just tuned in. I think when you were putting on the second half of the reading. I kind of identified with the idea of Muhammad Ali going globally, and as a matter of fact, as a sports figure in this part of the world, I think this is the beginning of his notability around the world, more so than any athlete who was born in this part of the world, based on primarily his own personality, on doing. One thing I noticed about Muhammad Ali, formerly known as Cassius Clay, is he stayed within his own understanding. He didn't try to act like he was smarter than somebody else. And he spoke very, very plainly, to whereas he could be understood by anyone, and he could speak on just about every subject. And his natural sense of humor and wit, he really stretched it just as far as I've ever seen any particular person. He was a very quick learner. If he heard something that sounded correct around him, it wouldn't take long for him to be repeating it. And in turn, I saw it being very useful to other people, because he certainly had choices where he did not have to be in the way of counter-racism. And so from that standpoint, I applaud him and what he did. And as I mentioned before, once again, before I get off this thing, I think this was the beginning of it, that trip he made to Ghana. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. Other folks who dialed in, everybody else who has a hand up should be with us. If y'all have commentary, feel free to share your thoughts, observations.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I agree with you. That's, I just wanted to start by saying I think that whole second reading kind of basically proves my agreement with Sancor's statement. The previously the firefighter in Florida brings to you too. Like he said, I think this was the beginning of that, but I think that all of what we read about his transformation, and especially the fact that he was able to connect with not just statesmen, but just the average person in these countries that he went to, really speaks volumes to his ability to become an elder statesman on an international scale and be a unifying force for Black people, both on the continent and in the diaspora as well. To get to the book itself, on page 234, Elijah Muhammad gives his son some really great advice. He says, "I don't want you around the ring boxing for any little fat white man with a big cigar," he lectured. "Don't be around the sports world. Sport is the ruin of our people. It turns them into children who are used and left broken. Stay out of it." And I thought that was brilliant advice, because when you look at how the sports world works, that's exactly what happens to our people. It made me think of Mike Tyson and how severely abused he was. And even to the point where at one point he was taking medication because he had mental problems. And the medication made him really docile and made him kind of sluggish. And even when he talked, his speech was slurred. I believe it was very powerful drugs they were giving him. But in order for him to win fights, they would take him off the drugs a few days before the fight. And he would become hyper-aggressive. And around those times is when he would get into a lot of trouble. And the white people didn't really care about his mental issues. They wanted him to perform. And at the same time, they were just robbing him blind. So, you know, we know the whole story, the tragic story of Mike Tyson. But ultimately, it just made me, to me, his story is like one of those really, really prime modern examples of what the sports world can do to us. It's just in reference to boxing, but it's in a lot of other areas of sports as well, where they can, really just make you childlike and dependent and then just destroy you in a way that you might not be able to necessarily recover from. I thought that there was a section, you love the fact that you focus on the scrutiny of the federal government via the FBI, because I think that is literally like just one of the most important aspects, probably the most important aspect of the book outside of them. The author is practicing racism and anti-blackness perpetually. But there's a section on the following page which says, although the story disappeared from the front page of the Chicago Defender, it caught the attention of the FBI. When special agents began investigating Herbert, an informant told them that he carried on extramarital affairs and was nearly possessed with taking nude photographs of women and making pornographic films. According to a quote-unquote reliable source, Herbert convinced women to pose for his camera in exchange for gifts of jewelry and mink coats. Of course, Ali did not know about any of this. He had only just met Herbert, after all, and Elijah had said that he could trust his son. Ali never questioned the messenger. He simply did what he was told. And I just find that telling, because that's exactly the type of stuff that the FBI would exploit. From what I know, J. Edgar Hoover was notorious for doing that to presidents. You know, he would have them staked out, find out their dirtiest, most grimy secrets, and then threaten to expose them, which is how he kept so many presidents under his thumb, to be able to do what he did with impunity to black people for the longest period in American history thus far. So I just found that to be very telling, and I just wanted to call that out. I found it really interesting on the following page, 236. They write, many Americans were just as outraged that the army had rejected Ali as he was that they refused to use his Muslim name. Furious citizens, soldiers, and veterans grumbled that Ali was certainly smart enough to peel potatoes, scrub a ship deck, or polish boots. A real American, they complained, would certainly find a way to serve. In Philadelphia, a concerned Irish Catholic mother whose son had been recently drafted resented the special treatment Ali seemed to receive from the military. She could hardly believe that Ali failed the military's entrance requirements. In a letter to President Lyndon Johnson, she asked why the Army did not draft the famous boxer. Is it because he's a millionaire and pays lots of taxes? Is it because he's heavyweight champion of the world? Is it because he's colored and colored people are being handled with quote-unquote kid gloves these days? Wow, the danger of white females. She literally said, I'm going to go to the president to get this nigga drafted as quickly as possible. Very interesting. I found it telling that that he said that white people in general, who he called furious soldiers and veterans, grumbled that he was smart enough to peel potatoes, scrub a ship deck, or polish shoes, which is the only job that black people can do, which is, they said, he can find a way to serve. I mean, that's all that any black people in this on this planet is doing, is serving white supremacy on one level or another. But they just had to degrade him to the point of, saying that, you know, he can peel potatoes and scrub a ship deck or polish boots. I just found that to be a very telling thing, and just white people being exactly what they are. I found it interesting on page 239, they wrote something interesting. It says, at the Quorry Methodist Church, Malcolm espoused the message fusing together electoral politics, self-defense, and pan-Africanism, framing the civil rights movement as part of a global struggle against racial oppression. We need to expand the civil rights struggle to a higher level, to the level of human rights, he suggested. Focusing on civil rights made blacks too dependent on the United States government, a government that had failed to protect their legal rights. Human rights differed from civil rights, he explained. Human rights were your God-given rights, recognized by the United Nations. And any time anyone violates your human rights, you can take them to the world court, he promised. At the UN, our brothers from Africa, Asia, and Latin America would finally hear the charges against the U.S. Uncle Sam's hands are dripping with the blood of the black man in this country. That particular lecture was the beginning of the end. That is when really they started, the United States government said, we're going to get rid of him. And after this was also the time frame where he reconnected with Dr. Martin Luther King, and they basically were able to reconcile, and basically Dr. King came on board with what he wanted to do. So this was really the start of the end for basically both of them, and this is what really facilitated them really moving towards neutralizing Minister Malcolm as quickly as possible. I find that to be a very poignant thing, because I believe Carl Evans in his book also alludes to that as well, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to give other people a chance to speak, but there were a couple other things that I wanted to get in, but I'll wait till, you know, if we have time at the end. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm.
Other folks who have not shared the second segment, we're kind of offering our views. Anybody else have comments they want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening again. Thomas Smith from New York. Great observations by Roz, a firefighter. I just wanted to say I've heard that argument made by several organizations about going through the UN. And recently, the UN just reported all kinds of things they found in Ferguson, Baltimore, Milwaukee. I mean, it was a scathing report, but I don't think anyone could do anything to the United States. So it's really pointless to go to the UN. I don't see them putting any troops here anytime soon. White people have way too many guns. And I just wanted to go on to talk about other points of the book. I find it very interesting the way that they depict Africa. And the way the writers wrote it, it was sort of like, you know, first thing, Time Life, to write, this is Time Life. I mean, to live in the outright lie in their depiction of Africa, and spread these lies, they called it myths. Like, no, that was straight up lies. I mean, that's deliberate acts of white supremacy. Key tool they use, you know, a black person gets off out the airplane and says, well, y'all got buildings. I mean, they told us y'all only had jungles and swamps and people was going to be walking around naked. And that's what they taught in school, like, and still do. And it's just, that's just not myths. That's a flat out lie. That's a flat out lie. Yeah, another thing they did, and I really hated that part where they was going through the Ali IQ, and I believe they said he had IQ of 80 or 78 or something, and I think Rogers touched on the swap of death or peel potatoes, and, you know, I'm like, this man grew up in Kentucky during Jim Crow. I don't know if Jim Crow was in Kentucky, but Kentucky's, I know they have the Klan and stuff there because it's between Virginia and Indiana. So, I mean, it's I know it couldn't be pleasant to be black and live in Kentucky in that time. And I know the schools and everything were just terrible for black people. So, I mean, how dare they even question his IQ? What did they expect him to bring a genius out of black Kentucky? I mean, that's just really, you know... And if, to talk about IQ, they also made it seem like Elijah Muhammad's son, you know, he wasn't that bright and this, that, and other, but he ends up being Ali's financial manager. I mean, he's managing a million-dollar athlete. I mean, so he wasn't no idiot. So I think that, you know, their IQ test is a form of white supremacy. I don't go by that. And, you know, I'll let other people go. It just really, you know, I mean, how can you judge someone on their mental capacity growing up in segregated Kentucky? And that's just ridiculous. I mean, my mind, thank
you. Other folks who have commentary, they wanted to make sure they got in. Anyone else that we haven't heard from yet have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? Please don't wait till the last minute. All right. I assume folks are at least good for now. Check one more time before we get ready to wrap things up.
Can I be here?
Oh, yes, sir.
What stood out to me, I think Thomas in New York just touched on it, the way that the Times magazine depicted Africa, and was that a direct quote from Ali when he was talking about the Africans on the, when he encountered some Africans on the beach or something like that? Was that a direct quote, or was that something that the authors just kind of threw in there?
Nope, it's a direct quote. All of that is quoted and in one of the other biographies, I think it's Muhammad Ali, Life and Times, where I've read a section of it before, where he I think they just quote a snippet from it, but where he, you know, has all these disparaging comments to make about Africa, and he later apologizes. I was wondering to see if they were going to include that, but they did not. But at any rate, they did. He did make these comments. It is quoted. It's in more than one book that, you know, where he did make these comments, which he later apologized for.
Okay, what I thought was interesting about that was the African's response to what he said. We might be mistaken for Negroes. That really stood out. And the FBI's monitoring of the Elijah Muhammad son and the focus on that. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Anything in particular about the FBI monitoring his son and the focus on that? Was anything about that stood out, or?
Sorry?
I said anything in particular about the FBI's monitoring surveillance of Elijah Muhammad's son and the focus on his alleged misdeeds, or?
Yeah, I mean, the part about when they said he broke some white woman's jaw in a few different spots, and it was like, you know, the woman wasn't even white, she was black, and then just the focus on his, I guess, sexual escapades or whatever, that just seemed really tacky. That's it.
Oh, for a bit, like it being included in the book at all, or just the fact that they were?
Just the highlight of it, you know, just it seemed like that they really shed like kind of like a negative light on him. And that just was, in my opinion, just kind of distasteful.
Got it. Let's see. I'll check in, see if we missed anybody before we get to the conclusion. We have about a little more than 6 minutes left in the program. With the whole this where you had whites who were angry about him not being drafted to go fight the Viet Congs, I'm reminded of Joe Lewis, who was drafted and had all of these enormous tax burdens and died broke and penniless, where they took all of his money, where he did not, you know, reap any of the benefits from his historic reign as heavyweight champion during World War II era. And even Jackie Robinson, who before he integrated baseball was a veteran and was still mistreated even while he was serving in the armed forces for his country, and then everything he had to endure once he stopped with all of that. I just have not seen any evidence that whites will do right by you if you're willing to go put on their uniform and go fight and invariably shoot, kill other non-white people in other parts of the world, that is not going to stop them from practicing racism, white supremacy against you, even Lavina Johnson more recently. Anyway, I thought it was interesting just paying attention to the word usage when they are describing Minister Malcolm and some of the comments that he made after he left the Nation of Islam, some of the speeches that he gave. I think even the speech, I believe, is called The Ballot or the Bullet, where they describe it as rhetoric. I think this popped up again. We talked about this before, where they classified or they branded his speech, his commentary, as rhetoric. We talked about, is that accurate or no? Is that an act of racism on their part in terms of just word usage? I would contrast, particularly in this segment, when in this speech where he's talking about what's happening here in the States to black people and saying that we are not Americans and, you know, we need to go to the UN, blah, blah, blah. I think before, I was questioning whether or not, since at the earlier portion in the book when they classified his speech as rhetoric, where he was talking about self-defense and if you put your hand on a member of the NOI, we're going to fight back, and then that didn't happen, would it be accurate to classify that as rhetoric? I believe Jackie Robinson did so in this portion, where in my view he's just giving an accurate assessment about classification, how you're treated, mistreated, and suggestions on what to be done about that. In my view, that would not be most accurate to brand that as rhetoric. But I contrast that. Minister Malcolm's speech is branded rhetoric when they can put these lies out about what's happening on the continent and, you know, they're swinging from trees and all of this. That gets broadcast as myths. Just in my view, that is when Mr. Fuller, others, when they talk about one of the major tools of racist man, racist woman, racist child is the use of words. That is it right there. Just something as simple as that, where a black person, they talk, it's mythology, or excuse me, it's rhetoric, or some other means of minimizing what you have to say. Even earlier when Muhammad Ali, when they said he made an instinctive choice, not an intellectual choice, just the use of words, how we think about what a black person does, what a black person thinks, whereas when whites, and it won't just be some, you know, bum on the street who's saying that, this is, I believe this is Time Magazine, make sure I have my magazine correct here where this was published. Is this in Time or is this in one of their other publications? Yep, Time. I was correct the first time. But yeah, where they can say that, you know, these folks are primitive and they've just got holes in the ground and they're just running around with no clothes on and happy-go-lucky gold coasters crowded their mud huts with radios, sewing machines, bicycles, and even TV sets, though there is no TV station to tune into, all in quotes. That does not get correctly indicted as an act of white supremacy, and a pretty massive one that continues right on up 2016. And again, and like I said, this has been a major pattern throughout the book, even in the way that they talked about, described Sonny Liston back when they were talking about their fight last week and the week before, the way he was described, the way Cassius Clay was described at that time. When you quote whites from this time period, and they're writing in a racist manner, and that doesn't get called out or identified by the authors, I think that's like double layers of racism going on, where it lends authenticity to the racists of yore, and it's them legitimizing their acts of racism because it does not get critiqued, it does not get called out in the same way that they're doing for Minister Malcolm, where he's deceptive, Muhammad Ali, he's deceptive, and blah, 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 and they're being very critical, Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, all the black people presented, basically, where it's a very different way that we presented and critique what they said, you know, 50 years ago. Some of the other things, let's see, the portion. Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well, where the black people, the Africans, did not want to be recognized as Negroes and mistreated on that basis. I thought that was significant as well. We had a lot of FBI quotes in the passage from this week that I thought was just, you know, just confirming pretty much what I've said the whole time, where it seems like a lot of these pertinent conversations that are really significant, really important, they are coming from FBI files. Even one of the notes that I made from the first audio segment where they're having one of these disagreements, this is footnote number 22, and this is in chapter 14, footnote 22, where they're talking about Elijah Muhammad, where he's upset and saying that, you know, Minister Malcolm is a hypocrite and that's the worst thing of all. And where he says, and this is all in quotes, where he says, "It was time to make an example of that no good long-legged Malcolm," he exclaimed. "Hypocrites like him could only be dealt with could only be dealt with one way. You cut their heads off." This is from an FBI file, and that's the only source that they have. I'm not saying that he didn't say that. I'm just saying that that's where they got this information from. Either you have an informant who is present, or you have some sort of electronic monitoring going on. Also, I thought it was important, the portion where Roz was talking about the racists who were upset that Muhammad Ali was not going to be inducted into the armed services. The authors in the footnotes have that note in their possession, the letter that this white woman wrote to the president, her fury about him not being drafted. Apparently they got however that happened in terms of going through the archives or whatever, but they have a copy, or they got the note in their presence to quote from. I thought that was fascinating as well. Again, whites are not ignorant about racism. I will stop there. We have about 60 seconds. If we missed anybody, you should probably speak up now if anybody has something concise that they can get in before we get ready to wrap things up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I did have a couple other things to read from the book, but I know we don't have time. The one thing I did want to say is when the thing that stood out most to me about the section where the FBI was following Herbert Muhammad was where they were able to get another black person to tell them what they needed to know. Whereas when they did it with Malcolm, because Malcolm actually recorded them, he told them to kick rocks. So there it is. Black people giving information, bad-mouthing, disrespecting other black people is what facilitated that information coming out. That's it. Thank you so much. Something to think about.
For sure. For sure. Fighting against anti-blackness, a very important aspect of how we can work to neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child.
Can I add one more thing, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Just wanted to point out in this section how Malcolm never had anything negative to say about Ali or Elijah Muhammad. That's it. Thank you.
Right on. All that information about Herbert Muhammad, that is referenced from an FBI file as well. I'm just further making the point about where all this information is coming from and what that reveals, what the sources for this information is. And even while I was reading all of that, the fact that I didn't see where there were any convictions. It just says that he was investigated, and they admit that they got this information from an informant, but still... that he was investigated for these allegations and, you know, breaking this woman's jaw, whatever it is he's accused of, at the time was accused of doing. It says she pressed charges. I didn't see where there was a conviction. He denied. I don't see anything about a conviction. I don't see anything about jail time. It's been my experience where there's any sort of black person and there are charges, you're being investigated, there's a threat where you could possibly be in jail. This is 50 years ago, particularly if whites are saying that you slugged a white woman, Nate Parker. Bad things can happen. That tends to be the type of thing where they say, well, hey, now you are going to be an informant, or you can, you know, be looking at these next 10, 15, 20 years in prison, or you can, you know, give us some details, whatever we need. Now you'll be taking notes, or we're in a while, whatever we, you know, want to do. That tends to be a pretty common way that whites practice racism. Even now, 2016, that's the type of thing that they tend to do, getting black people to, as they say, snitch on other black people so that they can, you know, just cause more damage and confusion and create conflict amongst black people. They have whole books that we've had on Alondra Nelson, her book Snitching, which she talks about. One of that is one of the main products is that you end up having a whole lot of black people that are very distrustful of other black people, and how that just creates a whole lot of conflict amongst black people and makes it difficult for us to try to work together and cooperate to solve our problems. But yeah, that is astounding all the way through. We will stop there. Again, we should have two sessions left and we'll be all done. We'll be picking up next week, kind of finishing the excursion on the continent and how that further transforms Muhammad Ali. If you have commentary that you would like to share, if you are not able to participate live, you want to get in kind of your concluding thoughts or what have you about the book, you can feel free to drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we will read it on the program next week or the week after when we wrap everything up for good. We will be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in. Looking forward to reviewing news observations from the past 7 days, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you can't find something in the archives, have difficulties, drop us an email. We will get you whatever help you need. With that, I will again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. I think Minister Malcolm would certainly encourage that, as would Muhammad Ali. We do not want to put ourselves in position where you are out and about and you bump into a race soldier badge or no, and are under the influence and not able to respond in the way that will best preserve your life and anybody else that you might be responsible for. Let's make sure that we are lucid, clear thinking as much as possible, really perpetually, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, so that we can think at the highest level, Dr. Welsing type levels, using our brain computers to solve this problem and just to preserve our life. It's one of the most valuable things. It is the most valuable thing that we have as black people. Again, buckle up every time that you're in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, and certainly no alcohol if you're going to be in a vehicle, driver, passenger, pedestrian. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.